Welcome to another episode of The Long Road to Ruin. I am your host, the mandated reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified, Mr. Mark Rattledge. And tonight, folks, I will do the impossible. I will be the Johnny Cochran to this saga's O.J. Simpson. I am going to defend the indefensible among anyone of the male gender. I, Mark Rattledge, will use this podcast to defend the Twilight Saga. Yes, I am stepping into the breach to tell you that these are not the five worst movies ever produced by man. These are not the worst representations of vampires and werewolves ever captured on celluloid. These are, in fact, not bad movies. At least, well, some of them. Some of them, it's kind of 50-50. But tonight, we're going to have a long, in-depth discussion about the Twilight Saga. And here at gunpoint is my co-host, my good buddy, the ringmaster of Music's 3Rs and 401mania.com. Here he is, folks. Now you never dull your colors for anyone else's bumping. Mr. Sean Comer, how do you do? Canvas.
You ever butcher my catchphrase like that again, and so help me, I will find a way to reach my fist through this phone and shove it down your throat.
Negative, 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 negative. Oh, wait, that's wrong, too. Sorry.
You know what? Actually, these aren't indefensible. Far from it. These are five of the greatest comedies ever made.
Oh, Sean, are you ready? Are you ready to bring the hate? Are you ready to be like a village full of angry mobsters, just ready to burn things down, hit them with a pitchfork, that sort of thing?
Well, you know what? Since I'm not doing the 3 R's anymore, I've got to do it somewhere. So,
are you done with the 3 R's officially?
Ladies and gentlemen, we just proved that Mark does not read my column.
I barely read 411 anymore, I got to be honest.
we'll just go ahead and get this passage right now during the pluggery section. Monday was my final 3 R's. I'm moving on to my column that debuts next Monday. So,
okay, and that's Give Music Back to Life?
Give Life Back to Music, yes. My God, you are all over the place. Just
so tired. all right. So if you think Sean's having a rough time having to put up with me, you ought to meet my wife. And you will. Tonight, folks, my film expert on this particular series, she's read all the books, she's watched all the movies, she happens to be a woman. Ladies and gentlemen, my beautiful wife, the mother of my child, Miss is Melissa Rattledge. How do you do?
I'm good. I have to keep giggling at you, though, because you are ridiculous.
Now, wait a minute. How am I ridiculous? And I know where you live, by the way.
No, just you make me giggle. That's all. I just have to stop and laugh at you.
You live with me. This is a regular conversation.
What?
I do all of this in regular conversations, screw up phrases, overly dramatic.
I think that's why it's making me laugh as much as it is, because I realize that, oh my God, I live with a man who's on, you know, basically on radio 24/7.
You're welcome.
Never, kids, never forget, if Mark has to suffer, so does everyone else.
Oh, yeah.
God damn right. All right, let's turn the pages on this bad boy and get started here. As I like to do with every one of these movie franchises, I like to know how people sort of came to them. What is it about them that drew them to it? So, Melissa, we'll start with you since you're our guest of The Long Road to Ruin. What was it about Twilight that brought you to it? Who introduced it to you, if anyone? Were you... For the sake of this podcast, I'm going to ask this like I don't already know the answer. Did you read the books first? Did you read the movies? Did you attend some sort of meeting among women that said you had to go by law?
We absolutely did. There was a secret female meeting, and basically in that meeting we are all told you must read these books and love them. No, not really. But basically what happened is it was summer vacation. I'm a teacher, so I have a lot of downtime in the summer. A really good friend of ours had actually just watched the first one, made me watch it with her, and she was telling me she was like halfway through the book, but it was the best book she's ever read, and that I needed to read it too. And I kind of looked at her like she was crazy because I'd seen all of the insanity in the bookstores and whatnot, and I was like, I'm not kind of not there yet. I kind of waited until all of them were out, and then I'd only ever seen the first movie, and then I plowed through the books, literally all four of them in probably a weekend, because I really couldn't put them down. As a girl, they really appealed to everything about being a girl. So it's, you know, it's a great love story, even if it was written for 14-year-olds. But it, yes, that was kind of where I came. That's how I came to it. I got to use the excuse of being a teacher, and I was reading them to try to get girls more interested in reading at school.
I actually remember that you were, when everyone else was sort of pointing and laughing, and you were saying, no, 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 I'm doing this for school. Wink.
Yep.
And
I did actually get, I did get one girl when I was teaching fifth grade reading. I did get one girl to actually start reading the books. And it was hysterical because she really, 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 really liked them, but nobody else was reading them, so she couldn't talk to anybody about them. And it was kind of the one thing that her and I had in common, considering she was from, you know, poor and black and 12. It was the one thing her and I had in common, and the one thing her and I wouldn't fight about. So that was kind of our, that was our one little, like, bonding moment there.
So to be clear, you're not a poor black 12-year-old.
I'm not a poor black 12-year-old.
Okay, just checking. because you needed to tell me that way before this conversation, if you were. And my last question before we move on with this is, how far are you into The Hunger Games based on the same premise that you do all of this reading for your students?
Oh, God, I can't even crack the book. You and I can't. I have it. My soon-to-be sister-in-law lent it to me to read it. And it's on my nightstand. I just can't crack it. And then I watch probably the first 20, 30 minutes of the movie, maybe a little bit more than that, I don't even know. But I can't get into it. It's just not my thing.
So you really can't then use the excuse, oh, I was doing it for the students. This was all about you
now,
and your Twilight love.
I'm a sucker for really bad romance.
Clearly. All right, now let's...
If I married you.
Exactly. A really bad romantic.
Yes.
So let's move over here to Sean. Now, Sean, you do not have a vagina, last time I checked?
Let's see. Nope, still intact.
All right. So how did you... So
even after watching this?
Yes, even after having seen both Twilight, seen New Moon and Eclipse twice.
Oh, my gosh.
So you did not attend the secret meeting of women that said everyone must watch these and love these. How in fact, as a male with a penis, did you come to Twilight?
It's funny you ask, actually. I really don't have much of an interesting story to how I came about it. Many moons ago, when the very first movie hit theaters, way back before she was my best friend, I was a rather avid reader of my dear Scarlett's blog, Scarletopia, and she at the time was dating a certain reputable internet personality whose name I won't soil my show with. I'll just say, you know, he's a guy who fucked the dog, and the dog fucked him right back. But they had kind of a regular date night at the time of going out to what became a regular date night of going out to check these movies out and just pretty much sit back, relax, and riff them the entire time. And she did a hilarious blog sending up the first movie. And then when the second one came out, her boyfriend posted a vlog on his site that just, I have to give him credit, actually legitimately made it sound like just about one of the most hilarious, absurd goddamn things there's ever been. And based on that, I decided, well, hell, I'm actually going to go brave the theater to go check this thing out. And lo and behold, at the time when I saw it, I hadn't laughed that hard at anything in a while. I think that's the comedy that washed the taste of grown-ups out of my mouth when I saw it. So, that's really about it. I happened to read one blog from my best friend saying that the first movie was hysterical. I watched the vlog saying that the second one was even more hilarious than the first. And based on that, I managed to stumble into five of the most horribly awesome comedies ever, unfortunately committed to film.
All right, so we have somebody who's a fan, who's a hopeless romantic and a fan of, you know, chick flicks and romance and all of that, and then somebody who thinks that these are the new version of the Rocky Horror Picture Show. This ought to be a good discussion.
Well, to get one thing clear here, and I want to make this crystal clear right off the bat, I actually am one of those rare guys that has no problems with a good romance. I have no problems with a good love story. It's just that this in no way, shape, or form resembles a good love story.
Okay. Let me hold you there because I want to come back to that. That's a big element to this discussion is the concept of romance in these movies. And that's actually a good jumping off point because I keep saying this. When I promoted this podcast tonight, I promoted it as In Defense of Twilight. And let me kind of tell my own little come to Twilight story. Obviously, I came to Twilight because of my wife. That's not the fun part. The fun part is once I was going to these movies with Melissa, I would then go read the 401 movie reviews, and the reviews themselves were whatever. I don't even remember them. Sorry, guys. But I do remember reading the comments. And if the comments were kind of problems with Kristen Stewart's acting, which are valid, and we'll talk about that, if they were structural problems with the movies, number five being the most glorious offender of terrible movie construction, I would have been okay with it, and I don't think we'd be doing this podcast other than I wanted my wife to be on at least one of these. My problem that I saw was with every single one of these, the comments were over and over and over again, they're destroying vampires. This was the worst use of vampires I've ever seen in my life. Just comment after comment after comment of men being angry about the use of vampires in this movie and werewolves to a lesser extent. And I looked at that and I thought about also a conversation that was had on the Michael Medved show that I actually called into and then was promptly cut off and hung up on. But I remember Michael Medved complaining about these movies and saying, I don't understand what the point of them is, who the hell would want to be a vampire and all of this other stuff. And I was trying to explain to him that it's not about that. It's a romance story told with horror monsters, which I thought was an interesting concept at the very least. But I feel like by and large, men in particular, but you know, maybe some women too, miss the point of these movies. And I think that's why I wanted to have this discussion tonight, was what was the point of the Twilight Saga? The point was to tell sort of a modern sort of Romeo and Juliet with a variety of modern themes to it. And one way to get people's attention is to use things that they maybe are familiar with and sort of do your own spin on them. So she chose, Stephanie Myers, who's the author of the books, chose to use horror monsters, but she could have gone and could have used Smurfs and He-Man. Who cares? You know, she could have used, tanks and planes. Doesn't matter. The point of this was to tell a story about a very broken young woman and sort of her story of, you know, finding herself and finding love and all of that with all of this other stuff happening around it. And that needs to be talked about. And that is very, very different from an argument that starts off with, these are horror monsters, and you're using them wrong. So let's get into this. I think, start thinking about criticisms, and Sean, you sort of alluded to this, This is, as I've said now, at least a zillion times, a love story. And I want to go to Melissa on this first, because, you know, something that you and I talked about as we rewatch these movies. If not personally, then at least in sort of a general sense, did you identify with the story that was Bella's story? That, you know, here we had the sort of broken individual who sort of found strength in this, in the Cullen family and being a vampire and all of that, and kind of rights herself by becoming a vampire. The other side of that being that she only feels, part of that being that she falls in love with Edward, and she kind of only feels right in the world when she's with him. Did that all make sense to you?
Yeah, well, it does. Honestly, I think what you have to think of it as is just they're horror characters, our typical horror characters. But we're talking about a girl who feels alienated in the world. And I think that that's a great parallel with a horror character because, you know, think about, I know he wasn't in it, but, you know, the whole idea behind Frankenstein's monster, you know, Frankenstein's monster was a man who wanted to fit into the world and didn't. So she kind of is that monster, I guess. You know, I thought it was a really interesting way for girls to relate to another girl who has that awkward feeling. You know, the backside of this, though, and the thing I don't know if anybody really anticipated was all of these teenage girls now being obsessed with finding a vampire or a werewolf to fall in love with. But, you know, the character of Bella, she kind of is that teenage girl. Most teenage girls, you know, can relate to her and went through some very similar feelings of, I don't fit in, I'm not right in my skin, I just am falling through life. And looking for that person or that place where they're going to fit in. Stephanie Meyer just happened to pull vampires and werewolves because it's a lot more fun. I mean, if it was, the nerd, the mathlete, and the football player, it wouldn't be as much fun. So I think that that's what it is. But, yeah, the idea of Bella, especially in the books, she is very relatable for girls. And even as an adult reading those books, I could remember being a 16-year-old girl, a 17-year-old girl, and, you know, having those awkward feelings and, you know, trying to fit in. So
before I go over to Sean, a criticism that one might direct at this movie vis-a-vis the Bella character is a woman finding a man to validate herself, which is a constant theme throughout the movies. You know, here on The Long Road to Ruin, I always say it doesn't matter what was in the book. It's the movie that counts for the purposes of this discussion. But it's kind of hard to do that with this. So we're going to try to separate the two. But like I was saying, I think a lot of people kind of looked at Bella and saw her needing to be validated through Edward as a negative thing. But that doesn't make I don't know if that necessarily makes the movie negative. That's her story. That's her character. And it's a strong character, and I think it's an honest character. What's your reaction to that?
That's the thing, is I don't think it's necessarily that she needed something to make her feel validated, and what she was finding it in was this concept of becoming like Edward. And so to me, I didn't see it as she needed the guy to validate her. She needed that change in the lifestyle to become stronger.
I think initially, though, she takes a lot of comfort in Edward's strength. You know, he's a superhero. He's, you know, speed and strength, and he can protect her. And my God, if there's one note that Edward beats to death in these movies, is he's her protector until she becomes a vampire. Then she's pretty good about protecting herself. Sort of, it's almost a role reversal. But again, I think that's something that we see in many modern women, certainly something that's not unheard of.
No, it's not unheard of. It's not. It's the common thing. I mean, girls, we all grew up on Disney princesses, and they all got flipped off their feet by a man. I mean, you know, they didn't do it themselves for the most part. I think the only one you could even start to even make the argument that maybe she did it for herself would be like Mulan, or even, you know, the newest one was Brave. But it's the stereotype that we're all born into. And good or bad, it's the stereotype, and it works for a reason. You know, it's kind of nice. It's that romantic notion.
Okay. So, Sean, you've been listening to us kind of bat back and forth, sort of the woman's point of view of this and the woman's point of view of a female lead and all of that. And sort of what's your reaction to this part of the discussion?
my reaction is really pretty simple at this point, if we're just talking about the first movie right now. And really, this is the movie that really got arguably the least reaction to. And that is the fact that even if it's realistic and it's relatable, it's still a character that's absolutely agonizing to watch.
Why is it agonizing to watch?
I don't disagree with you on that at all.
Are you going to disagree with me at that at all, or not?
No, she's with you all the way.
I'm with you. I'm with you 100%.
That's the thing. I mean, points for realism. I will grant Melissa that one. Granted, I've never been a teenage girl myself, but I grew up around one. When I was a teenager, I was obviously friends with a number of them. To the utter shock of a lot of people who probably listen to me every 2 weeks, I even managed to date a few of them. I can see everything that Melissa's talking about. All that being said, God in heaven, what a static, bland, obnoxious character. The thing that gets me about her throughout all the movies is the fact that she arguably develops, second maybe only to Edward, developed the least of any of the characters along the way. She's changed the least by all of these experiences that supposedly should be altering her entire worldview. I mean, she still kind of remains the same throughout, and then it's like in about last movie and a half, all of a sudden they decide to go into hurry up offense and then start playing catch up with actually developing her character.
Well, let's pause and let's talk about that. Let's walk through Bella's story in what's really five movies, okay? She meets Edward, and we're introduced to her. So they have to spend time getting to know her and who she is and what she's all about. Then they have to spend some time introducing the Cullen family and what they're all about. And, you have this love story, and, oh, by the way, it's also an action film. I think this is the one thing where I agree with people, where Twilight's tonally sort of all over the place. Because on the one hand, it's a romance tale. On the other hand, it's an action movie where vampires go to war with each other and fight wolves.
But I'm going to throw in, I know that you don't like the book comparison, but this is to me where you get the really clear split, though, because the books were not written that way. That clearly was Hollywood saying, we know girls are going to drag boyfriends and husbands and, whoever else with them to see these. Maybe we should give the guys something that they might enjoy a little bit in this movie instead of just all of the, sucky, facey, curly, romancy stuff. Drives me crazy.
You know how I kind of perceived it? I think these five movies combined probably rank only below Charmed on the list of franchises that tried to do Buffy and just missed the fucking point entirely.
Sure.
That's possible. I mean, okay, I'm a horrible person. I never watched Buffy or any of that kind of stuff, so, because that wasn't what I was into. But I could see where that comparison could come through. Because it's kind of that play of like, oh, here's the supernatural piece, and let's have some love in there.
But it's not just that. I mean, the part that I think they missed was the fact that Buffy was able to pretzel genres all into each other. It was able to be funny. It was able to be romantic. It was able to be filled with action. It was able to be pretty damn grim and gruesome at its best, actually. But along the way, what this one really missed out on that Buffy nailed so perfectly, almost letter perfect throughout all seven seasons of the show, and actually even you could say right on into Angel, was character development. These experiences changed people. visibly. You could actually see them. You know, it was interesting to go back to watch the entire series and then go back and watch again from the beginning and have in mind to be able to see how each of these experiences really shaped them into the people that they eventually became.
I think that's what I was trying to get to before was,
well, yeah,
I'm not disagreeing with you, Sean. I think what I'm identifying is sort of the problem here. So like I said, in the first movie, they're introducing all of this stuff, and you know you're in for a long trip because you've got three other books to get through. In the second movie, she spends a third of it depressed, which, you know, I do want to talk about that because cinematically there were some interesting choices there.
Because it was, yes.
But so she spends a third of it depressed, and then she spends a third of it building a relationship with Jacob. And then, you know, Jacob's having his own issues. And then, so there was, I think, and I can't believe I'm about to say this, but I almost feel like there wasn't enough time spent on any one thing in any of these movies to do the kind of character development that you're talking about. Because books are not film, which is the motto of The Long Road to Ruin, apparently, because I keep saying it. And, you know, even The Lord of the Rings, which is about as perfect as you're going to get of an adaptation to a film, couldn't get it all in. You had to make some choices, and I feel like kind of what Melissa was saying was, you know, you have producers and directors and writers trying to figure out what is the best representation of these books so that we can get the widest audience possible instead of just teenage girls and middle-aged women.
Well, that was the craziest thing, though, is then they would add random stuff into these movies that weren't even in the books because they were trying to appeal to a broader sense.
And it's funny that you said before, like, oh, I want to throw things in there that get the men going. Because if you'll recall, my favorite one is Eclipse, only because it ends in a giant vampire war.
Yeah.
In a vampire war
that
actually
ends. If I remember correctly, you got really into that when we were at the movie theater, too.
I do think
I recall an oh, shit, or two out of you on that.
It was great. And I was telling you when we rewatched these, if they had just ended the goddamn series with Eclipse, I'd have been very happy. You know, but yeah, we don't need Breaking Dawn at all. But we'll get there in a moment.
No, we need parts of Breaking Dawn because, as a lover of the books, I wanted to see some things played out.
Sure.
But they didn't do it very well. But that's later. So.
Yeah.
You know, and Melissa, maybe you could either confirm or deny this. Because.
Mm-hmm.
Quite frankly, if I die having never read the Twilight book, mission accomplished, in my opinion. But I seem to remember either reading or hearing somewhere that actually Steph Meyer originally conceived the whole thing just as a trilogy and just kind of caved and wrote the fourth book as essentially a way of saying, if I give you another book, will you shut up?
I've heard some other things, too. What I would say is I feel like it's not totally true because if that were the case, then in the third book you would have had the transformation happen.
Yeah.
And it's like you've only read, you know, if you ended it there, you would be missing a lot of kind of the ending of the story. So it did. I don't think she intended it to go nearly as in-depth as it went, but I do think that there was going to always be a fourth book.
Well, and you know,
the one that everybody was clamoring for is, God, this is like the nerd in me. There is actually a book called Midnight Sun that she started writing, and it is Twilight written from the perspective of Edward. And that one, though, that got leaked, and she stopped working on it.
See, and you know, I have to admit, there are going to be a few parts in this series where I am actually going to give them credit for a job well done, even if it's just for small details. I will say this. The climax of Eclipse, for as boring as the rest of the damn movie was actually pretty awesome. It was way too short, but quite honestly, if the whole thing had just ended the way Eclipse ended, if it just ended the franchise there, I would have been totally happy. I think that would have been a perfect place to stop. I think that would have been totally satisfying.
This point so that we can move forward. So, you know, Eclipse, dealing with sort of the end of the whole action part of this, which is Victoria's been trying to kill Bella for the last two movies, and, you know, this is it. This was the climax of that particular storyline. And then in the next two movies, you're dealing with, finally, they've gotten rid of the biggest threat that they've got, and they can finally be together. They get married. They have the kid. She becomes a vampire. And to kind of bring this back around to your initial complaint about it is, well, a better told story could have had character development in your major characters throughout all four and a half of these movies. Unfortunately, because they had so many balls in the air and they weren't particularly well written, I see what you're saying as far as the character development was not as far along as it should have been. But the other side of that is, how much more developed did Bella need to be to get the story told? Because I think when she finally becomes the goddamn vampire and you see that transformation, I'll tell you, she is agonizing to watch for four movies, but by the time you get to Breaking Dawn Part 2, it is the only part of that movie I really liked, was Bella finally shedding her mopey, I breathe way too heavy into the boom mic skin, and becoming sort of an alive, living for the first time in five movies, just being alive on camera. And that was fun for me. I actually enjoyed that.
Yeah, but by then it was too late to give a milligram of a shit.
You're mean. We've spent some time talking about Bella here. Now, you said that Edward did not particularly move along his character either. Let's just talk about him for a moment. Because I'll tell you, like I said, you know, there's a lot of focus on Bella and whether or not she develops as a character. I don't think Edward gets enough criticism.
But he's not supposed to develop. That's the thing, though. Like, his big development happens when he decides that he's going to let this human into his world. That's his big development. That's his big change. I mean, we're talking about a guy who in, you know, almost 100 years, you know, had lived many, many lives. His character development happened and we never even read it.
Well, that's what I wanted to get to. One of the themes that I actually find interesting about this, and I'm gonna keep bringing this back to maybe, you know, the problems that a lot of the men and critics have had with these movies, because they're sort of odd things to capture on screen, especially in the summer blockbuster, you know, big time motion picture industry. And that is the concept of self-loathing. God, these movies were full of it. If there's one thing,
everyone hated themselves.
Yeah, everyone hates themselves in these movies. You know, Rosalie, one of the vampires, and she has a great line in I can't remember which one it is now, but she has a great line in one of the movies. She was like, I'm going to say no to you being a vampire because I wish someone had voted no for me. Edward doesn't want to be a vampire. Nobody wants to be a vampire in these things, you know, except for Bella. So I found that an interesting thing to watch over the course of five movies is your heroes being just being very uncomfortable with who they are, which is, of course, Bella's whole thing, too. So it all fits together. Melissa, do you want to speak to that at all? The whole concept of self-loathing on, you know, and trying to capture that on film and make it interesting for people?
I think that it was a big piece of the book. I don't think they necessarily showed it as well in the movies, which is kind of something that always annoyed me because there's so much inner dialogue that happened and discussion that happened. It always annoyed me that you never got more of it from them. Outside of that, I mean, I don't know what else to say about that part. I mean, they all hated each other. That was the thing. They all hated themselves. And that was the big theme of the book, is nobody is ever happy with themselves. You know, we all are going to have something we don't like about ourselves.
Sean, is that one of the things that drove you crazy about these movies is, you know, for five movies, you have to sit there and watch people hate themselves on screen when, you know, your heroes are supposed to get you to cheer them, not pity them.
You know what? What gets me about it is the fact that this is a concept that's been done before, and it's occasionally been done well. Unfortunately, it's also been done to fucking death.
Give me some examples.
Well, the best example is, I'm sorry, this is the curse of Anne Rice upon the world.
Are you talking about her Dirty Sleeping Beauty books?
God in heaven, if I could erase one series of books from existence, it would be the Vampire Chronicles.
So not the Dirty Sleeping Beauty books.
I have no idea what in every blue hell you're talking about.
Yeah, you know, I don't either.
You know, you didn't know Anne Rice, under a pseudonym, wrote a bunch of, like, XXX, I think it was Sleeping Beauty. Yeah, it was. A bunch of, XXX,
no,
Dirty.
The only thing I know about Anne Rice is she lives in New Orleans. She's really into vampires, and apparently now she's a born-again Christian.
Yeah.
Nope. Anne Rice,
that's
under
what
a pseudonym. Anne Rice, under a pseudonym, wrote Dirty Books. So go on.
Good for Anne Rice.
So she's what, pretty much the demigod of fanfic?
Yeah.
You know what? She really is, though. And I feel, it's interesting. I hadn't even thought about that before, but you're right. I feel like Stephanie Meyer is kind of like teenage girls, the teenage girls version of Anne Rice.
The claiming
Rokelar,
The Claiming of Sleeping Beauty, Beauty's Punishment, and Beauty's Release. But these were a bunch of BDSM Sleeping Beauty books. You're welcome.
Well, fabulous.
I'm not saying anything that nobody else has said before. But you know what? Even for as hamtastic as Neil Jordan's Interview with the Vampire is, just to kind of keep it talking about movies instead of books here, even for as hamlicious as that is, I gotta hand it to the actors who played the vampires in that movie. They brought some personality to it. They actually brought, like I said before, a feeling of a little bit of development, a little bit substance to what is really such a silly concept. And that is, like you pointed out, this idea that nobody wants to be a vampire. There was none of the closest thing you get to that is in some of the more malevolent vampires, you maybe get just a little brief fledgling touch of that Lestat kind of drunkenness with power. But I mean, it's almost like Robert Pattinson, who I think is a better actor than he shows himself to be here. It's almost like he couldn't even be bothered to try to pull off kind of half-assed David Boreanaz's impression. God love him. I actually think the only one who really displays any real type of character, any real attempt at actual acting, is, God bless him, Taylor Lautner. Hey,
I agree with you completely.
We were going to get to him next.
He and Ashley Green throughout this entire series strike me as the only ones who seem to be just exuding any kind of effort. I mean, Robert,
I think Reed did too, though, the one who played Rosalie. I think she did too. I think you saw in the beginning where she was very anti-everything, and by the end, you saw some stuff about her.
I'll give you Rosalie, but I get that Robert was trying to carry off brooding. I understand that. But instead, the only impression I got with every look he gave the camera, with every line he read, even during the tepid, awkward sex scenes, was, I could kick you square in the bloodsucker daddy bag, and your expression just wouldn't change, would it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but is that a fault of the direction, or is that a fault of the acting? You know, if he's supposed
to... He's pretty. It doesn't matter. He's pretty.
You say that like they're mutually exclusive, Mark.
But I just want to go back to my wife, and this is why I'm glad we have, you know, a woman on this particular podcast. Melissa, when talking about his acting or is it his direction? When talking about Robert Pattinson's performance, your reaction was again?
He's pretty.
Long road to ruin, everybody. Good night.
But that's, I mean, that to me was what he needed to have been, is he was supposed to be pretty. I mean, you know, teenage girls were going to watch this movie and drool, and they wanted him to, that, and why not drool over Robert Pattinson? I can't think of a better person to drool over.
Well, I guess that's my big problem. I'm not a big Dashboard Confessional fan, and that's who he reminded me of.
So what we're saying here is that if you're trying to market a movie to teenage girls, you don't have to have good actors. They just have to be pretty. Thank you, everyone.
Oh, did we say boy bands? I mean, think about that. Any marketing to teenage girls is all about looks.
Mark,
girls
you're
are vapid. Look, I know I am one, but girls are pretty vapid. They're really that shallow.
You're gonna make me do the song.
Oh. Okay, well, directed at Melissa, if you're going to do it.
I'm directing it at both of you. Wrong, 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 wrong. Wrong, 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 wrong. Bullshit, you're wrong. No, you know what?
Hang on, neither one of us are a Doctor Who fan. I just want you to know that. Neither one of us have ever watched Doctor Who.
That wasn't Doctor Who, that was Scrubs.
I don't watch that either.
Yeah, neither did I. I always thought you were just doing your own little Sean bit there. I didn't realize you were ripping something else off. Go on.
No. That's just my, if I may brag a little bit, fairly good Dr. Perry Cox impression.
That was it, Perry Cox. Doctor Who. The last time you brought this up. All right, I've now interrupted you twice. Please tell us why it is important that you should have actors in your film directed towards women and not pretty cardboard cutouts.
Okay, again, I'm going to harken back to Buffy for a second. You had a show that had a big fan base among teenage girls. I recognize this because, again, I was in high school with a lot of teenage female friends during about the first half of Buffy's run, up through about season, I think, 5-ish or so. And you know what? While it was rare he ever exactly set the screen on fire with charisma, I gotta hand David Boreanaz credit. David took what Pattinson is trying to pull off here and actually really did kind of bring a convincing sort of sense of gravitas to his brooding. And it was really the same kind of character. The only difference is they went with the whole fact that Angel was a vampire who had been cursed with a soul. And it was the fact that he was immortal but had to walk the earth feeling all of the remorse for all of the lives that he had taken. And really, seeing he could be just about anything else except for what he is. I could even also point out that later in the series, they kind of did the same thing with Spike, who was played by James Marsters. So, no, you can have good actors. You absolutely can.
You
absolutely
you
can, dude.
You just don't have
no. to. Well, right. If you're a total easy ass, you can settle for Robert Pattinson.
But I think that was what they did, though. I think in these movies, they wanted money. This was about money. This was not about character development.
We're not making art here, Sean. We're not making art.
I don't think Joss Whedon was actually dining on ramen and RC Cola when he made Buffy, though. I think he actually did okay.
Let's talk about Taylor Lautner as Shirtless McGee, Jacob.
That's my favorite memory that I have to just of Twilight movies was in the second movie when he took off his shirt and you and I were in the theater and all you hear is every girl in the theater go when he took his shirt off. That was like probably the funniest thing in my life.
I'm sorry, they went what? I didn't catch that. They went what?
Oh. Yeah. And you know what, sweetie pie? If that had been a theater full of 35-year-old men jizzing themselves over a teenage girl, oh, the cops that would have been called.
Oh, the sheriff's department would have been called out.
They were all underage. They were all underage, I'm sure.
Oh, my hell.
I was like, except for where Mark and I were sitting, because that was the 21 and up section.
First of all, no, wait a minute. We saw New Moon at Cine Bistro, I thought, which was all adults. Don't hand me that.
We saw it at the West. No, no, no. We saw it at the Wesley Chapel one, which is the upstairs is 21 and up, and then down, whenever we were above the rest of the theater.
All I know is I got hit in the face with estrogen, so I'm just saying. Taylor Lautner's Jacob is an interesting character in that he, at first, he's just sort of getting to know Bella, and he likes her, but he doesn't have, at least in the film, it's not portrayed as he has these super strong feelings for her. And he's sort of a minor character in the first film. The second film, that's his movie. At this point, Edward has left Bella because he feels like she'll be safe if he's out of her life, and then she doesn't worry about being a vampire and all that. So after some time, and I want to go back to this a little bit more when we start talking about the movies individually, but after some time, she ends up going to Jacob for solace, and that's when they start to really build a relationship, and he falls in love with her. And at the same time, he just now discovers that he's a werewolf, and he's got this whole new thing in his life that he's got to figure out what to do with, and all that it means and whatnot. And so it's actually it was an interesting sort of verse chorus verse in as far as, you know, girl falls in love with boy, boy leaves her, girl falls in love with another boy, that boy leaves her too, at least for a period of time. But
girl
he
figured out maybe it's me.
What was that?
Girl never figures out maybe I'm the problem.
Well, and this movie would have been better off if Bella had been played by Taylor Swift. Now listen, that should have gotten a laugh.
It's a fantastic arrangement there.
All right, but getting back to Jacob for a second, I do want to get you guys' opinion on this. But I think Jacob, probably of the three of them, does the best job of dealing with internal agonization on screen. He's got to deal with Bella. He's got to deal with the wolf thing. He's got to deal with all of the external threats going on throughout these movies. And going back to Bella, to a greater degree, he has to deal with what it all means that she wants to be a vampire and how that affects him in his world. I think he does the best job of handling all that and portraying it on screen without becoming Kristen Stewart, who was way too throaty and mopey, or being Robert Pattinson, who was way too tin wood. I think is where we're all at with this. Well, so just kind of your 50 words or less, Melissa, on his portrayal of Jacob Black.
I think he was dead on it.
Without mentioning the fact that he was both pretty and shirtless.
Well, yeah, I mean, that helps. But no, I mean, truthfully, though, I actually, one of the things I've been thinking about as we've been sitting here is he is the only one of those main characters who is not an established actor. You know, he didn't have this huge resume coming into the movie. So part of me wonders if, you know, he saw this as, okay, this is my big chance. I'm going to launch myself. And so not only am I going to be the pretty guy who takes his shirt off and is a wolf, but I'm actually going to show that I can do some acting in front of all of these people who have a career, you know, and so I can launch myself. And I'm wondering if he was hungry for it and the others weren't, and that's why we saw him actually show the development and actually put some effort into the acting versus his counterparts. But no, I mean, I think he did I thought he actually did a good job of showing that he was dealing with conflict. I thought he did a great job of being that cute little 16-year-old who had a crush on the girl and, you know, trying to prove that, you know, he's the better one. I actually really loved it. I thought he actually did a good job of trying to, you know, suck you into his world.
Okay, Sean, any thoughts on Jacob? Because after this, I do want to talk about not necessarily Bella, because we've covered that, but we must talk about Kristen Stewart.
You know, oh, yes, we'll get to you, my trout mouth little dumpling.
Oh, my God.
You know what? To be perfectly honest, I think Melissa summed it up pretty well. I think Let It Be Forever to Robert Pattinson and Kristen Stewart's shame that this teenage upstart pretty much really acted circles around them over the course of, didn't do much in the first one, about four out of five movies. And that's including him basically becoming a cuddly pedal bear in the fifth movie.
She did an awesome job at it. I have to say, it was really cool because you could actually see him being like, I don't love this, but I'm going to do it anyway. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. And you see, and this is what I'm talking about. I mean, this is something that really, maybe I wouldn't say that Pattinson should have just aped mannerism for mannerism, line for line, but he could have maybe stood to have cribbed a little bit of that conflict and brought it to Edward, at least in some kind of subtle sense, to make it a little bit interesting.
I think Robert Pattinson was channeling Dylan from 90210. That's the only thing I can tell you. That was the direction that he was given.
And you know what? That's an absolutely superb comparison. That's a very apt one. And really, consider that Taylor managed to do that despite the whole concept of the werewolf in these movies. Admit it, it's downright silly.
It's a cuddly dog.
Silly? They establish that they're an Indian tribe. They establish they're an Indian tribe with a weird genetic thing that makes them turn into werewolves. Okay, werewolves by themselves are a silly concept. Let's not go down that road. What they do in the movie and the device that they serve, what about them is silly? They're there to protect humans from vampires and not make a big stink about it, no pun intended. What's the issue?
The transformations are funny. The fever.
The American Werewolf in London? You want them to have this long, drawn-out Hulk scene where they're tearing at their own skin?
Might have been more interesting. I can see what Sean said about that, though. It is kind of a silly concept how it works.
Yeah.
And how, like, oh, more showed up, so now more of us are going to become werewolves.
That actually makes sense to me.
Plus, if you read between the lines, it's and again, I'm going to take Stephanie Meyer to task for this one. It's just how fucking ham-fisted and contrived and forced a homosexuality metaphor it is. You can't even call it thinly veiled. You almost have to call it a lampshaded metaphor, really. There's the fact that apparently it is somehow tribal law that every werewolf transformation must be preceded by dramatically ripping off one's Abercrombie T-shirt.
Wait a minute.
That comes right out of The Incredible Hulk. Every time Banner turned into Hulk, his clothing tore away. At least the wolves were smart about it and took their clothing off before they transformed. So they lest they rip their clothing to shreds and have to constantly go to the Target to buy more.
Actually, there's something really funny about that. In the books, they actually have a big discussion about how they've figured out these guys that when they transform, they'd rip their clothing. So they created, actually, they didn't show them on any of the wolves in the movie, but they would have special pouches that they would actually put their clothing into to wear so that when they morphed out, they could get dressed again.
Oh, but unfortunately, we must defer to the great law of fan service. So instead we just have shirt randomly ripped off, and that's your money shot for any of the werewolf scenes.
But it wasn't random. They're not trying to destroy their entire wardrobe. They knew that a lot of these were. I mean, unlike the Hulk, this wasn't like they couldn't. You know, the car jack fell on them and they got angry and blah smash. That only happened.
Oh no, but that is what happened though.
No,
there
and
were a
one,
couple scenes where that was what.
It's very rare. The rest of them are controlled transformations, where it would make sense that they would, do it. I mean, liken it to Superman. He goes into a phone booth. He spins around a few times, and out he comes. You know,
well,
and decked out in his red and blue.
And again,
it's not homosexual. It's Superman.
And again, let's also address it. Pack of dozens of half-naked, fit Indian
boys
bunched together, no women, and nobody's even remotely going to lampshade this. No?
It's
okay.
Not a choice. It's not a choice.
It's not a lifestyle choice.
That's right. And there was one girl later on in the movie who becomes a vampire, a werewolf.
She becomes a wolf, yeah. And she hates it the whole time.
Yeah.
And she does nothing but complain about it.
She's, I don't know, maybe it's just being around all the other boy wolves. Maybe she's a lesbian wolf.
Oh, my God. Love you like a brother, but I just don't see these things that you're pointing out. I think the wolf stuff, in the universe that this movie exists in, where this stuff is real, let's remember that we are talking about, you know, extremely fictionalized ideas here. Werewolves, despite what LiveScience.com said, there are no such things as fucking vampires or werewolves. So,
Something mean, Gene, when you've watched as much Lost and as much Doctor Who as I have, you learn to strain credulity a little bit to make something make sense.
I thought the werewolves thing made sense. I thought for the purpose in the universe that these movies exist in, the least problem I had was with the wolf lore. And again, I'm going to say it on this podcast, and I will forever go to this in my defense of these movies. I don't care what happened in The Lost Boys. I don't care what happened in Underworld or Bram Stoker's Dracula or American Werewolf in London or Teen Wolf or whatever movies you people love. This was an entirely new idea by an author who decided to do her own spin on these things. She has that right. She has that right.
I know. We're just pointing out that there are not ways to do it.
Fair enough. Okay, I want to talk about the films individually for the next little bit. But before we do, let's just let the trout face out of the bag. And let's say this entire saga rests upon the shoulders of its main lead. And I think the worst thing about this movie, the one valid criticism that I see about them, other than some structural problems, is Kristen Stewart cannot act. You know,
she plays the same character in every movie she's in.
I swear to you,
the same as her character from Adventureland.
Yeah, I was gonna say I didn't even think of Adventureland, but you and I watched Snow White and the Huntsman, and I wanted to watch that movie, one, because I love sword and sandal movies, you know, Lord of the Rings and all that, but also because I wanted to see if Kristen Stewart could pull off anything other than I'm currently having stomach problems acting. Kristen Stewart, I don't know who's directing you. But heavy breathing into a microphone and looking like the face hugger rather from Aliens is about to jump through your chest is not really acting, and she acts like she's permanently got diarrhea, and that's not acting. This woman, I, and this is what I want to ask you, Melissa. This is where I need your expertise here. Again. Books are not movies, and movies are not books, but I want to know, for the purpose of this discussion, how close to the mark did Kristen come to getting Bella correctly? On a scale of 1
she
to 10.
She has the hair color, right?
Hang on, because I guess I know where you're going with this, but 10 is she fucking nailed it. Kristen Stewart was Bella. 1 is I could have done a better job.
She's probably at like a 3 or 4, truthfully.
Okay, why?
I mean, she just, it goes back to, this is a person who every movie she's in, she does the same thing. She had no depth. She did nothing to make you believe that she was going through. Half the time, I didn't even think she was actually in love with Edward. You know,
what was one of the big criticisms we had in the first couple of movies where, like, he's leaving her? This man has infected this woman.
No,
with
don't.
This yeah. No, don't. Could not emote her way out of a paper bag.
No, she really couldn't. And it actually upset me. And the first times I watched the movie, you know, and the first times I saw the movies, I remember kind of being like, oh, she's not the best actor, but I was so enthralled in what was, you know, what, at the comparison in my mind going on and watching what was coming out, that I didn't think about it. But, you know, as time has gone on and I've seen them more and realized just how bad she was, and I don't understand how she got the part. I mean, I've read the stories about how she got the part, and clearly the first director just sucked or was a horny teenage girl herself who wanted just to see Robert Pattinson make out with someone. I don't know. But she just, it bothers me now because I just think that you have a character that could have been this awesome, have actual development because the book has development,
Well, that's what I wanted to get from you. Before you continue, this is what I want from you right now. Tell me about Bella in the book in 50 words or less, and then explain to me why Kristen doesn't, besides the fact she can't act, what she's doing wrong.
Bella in the book, the whole time, she's always trying to figure out how to fit in. It's less about, I want to be a vampire, and it's more about, you know, why don't I fit in? She questions a lot. And I feel like in the book, in the movies, you got none of that questioning. You know, Bella was always kind of searching for an answer and questioning what was happening and why was it happening that way and seeking out answers. And she was, you know, yes, she was kind of a weakling, but she was always trying to find the answers. And in the movies, you have this person who is so flat and just everything happens to her. And there's no her pushing through it or trying to question it in any way.
She sounds like a much more interesting person in the book than she does in the movie.
In the book, you really can. I mean, I think a lot of girls, why they love these books is because you can totally understand the character. And then you watch the movie and you're just like, yeah, okay.
Why am I rooting for you?
She looks like what you would think Bella would look like, and that's about it.
That's probably why she got the part, aside from the fact that she gives a good blowjob.
Apparently, how she got the part was she and Robert Pattinson made out in the director's bed. That was how she got the part.
Isn't that how most movies get made?
Robert Pattinson had the part first, and the first director, that original one, they were doing a screening. They had her come to the house, and the two of them started making out, and
I believe that's how Idris Elba got the part in Pacific Rim. He made out with one of the gaijus in the director's bed.
Mm.
And the director was all of a sudden just like, I'll be in my bunk.
Sean, you and I are going to have just a couple of minutes here to just talk about her on-screen performance, because, again, not having read the books and focusing on the movie, I think, as I said, she can't keep still in front of the camera. It's everything she reacts to is just her being throaty and breathing heavy. And then, as I said to Melissa, and we both laughed about this, in the most critical parts of the movie where you must feel, you must relate to this character and feel her pain, she sounds more like she's angry that she stepped in dog shit. And that's about what comes across. So give me your best Sean. You know, Sean all over Kristen Stewart's performance for me.
So if Kristen Stewart looks the way one would imagine Bella would look from reading the books, does that mean that Stephanie Meyer at some point described her as a bony, mildly attractive Starbucks barista with an expression like a goldfish who perpetually looks like she's trying hard not to pass the Incredible Hulk through colon?
As I'm reading through the book now, that's page 7. Sorry, go ahead.
This is not acting. Not even remotely close. And in fact, I kind of wanted to cry a little bit when I found that she was cast as one of the leads in On the Road, because On the Road is one of my all-time favorite books. And now I have to say that the movie of it starred Kristen Stewart. That makes me throw up in my mouth a little. Do you know how wrong throwing up in one mouth tastes when one has spent the last hour sipping on a glass of chocolate orange port? It's wrong. You and I talked before the show briefly, and we wondered if, I think it was either you and I, myself, and someone else I was talking to about this show, wondered if Jennifer Lawrence would have done a better job. And, you know, quite frankly, I don't know, because all things considered, it's not like my problem with this movie was that the dialogue was great and it's totally delivered. The problem was it was a mix of the fact that the dialogue was pretty laughable for the most part, and and the fact that Kristen Stewart has a constant expression on her face that she's trying to figure out who on the set farted.
I was more thinking it was she has a look that she farted and she's trying to hide it. Actually, I would say Kristen Stewart most of the time looks like she's trying to carry out the direction as if she farted and shit her pants and can't get off the set to change her knickers.
She brings absolutely nothing to it except the fact that New Moon, she is absolutely convincing as the soulless, self-absorbed, manipulative, destructive little harpy that Bella, I have to gather, is pretty much supposed to be throughout the entire movie. I mean, if the idea of that was to make me wonder, what in God's name does anybody want being in your pants, then mission accomplished, I guess.
You want to take that one, Melissa?
I don't even know how to answer it, truthfully. I mean, I don't. I just, yeah.
Answer it as a girl. I was going to say, answer it as... Bella's not supposed to be attractive to men. Men aren't the audience for this thing. She was supposed to be attractive, in a sense, to women. So, mission accomplished?
But if you... Her character in the book, though, wasn't attractive necessarily. She was kind of mousy and ordinary and very plain. And
what I'm saying by attractive is... attractive, not necessarily in the ooh-la-la sense, but attractive is in... people are drawn to her. You as a reader are drawn to her.
You're drawn to her because you can relate to her. That's the thing, and that's the biggest mistake, because here we've casted this person that I don't think anyone can relate to because she has no personality.
Okay. All right, let's turn the page here, and because I do want to talk about sort of the plot and structure of these things. I think we spent enough time and we'll come back to individually certain lesser characters like Jasper and Alice, Rosalie, the whole Cullen clan, and some of the villains as we talk about these movies. Because I do want to make sure they get mentioned. I happen to like Jasper. He's one of my favorite lesser characters in this. So I want to.
He's one of mine too.
I want a movie about what the Volturi are doing behind those closed doors just before someone walks in. Seriously, you know what, even just take like a 15, 20 minute short of it, where you take any scene where somebody is walking into their hall and just you are depicting what they're doing, what they're talking about before somebody walks in. I don't know, are they pulling out like PlayStation Vitas and playing Madden? Are people texting?
Men, Sean. They are learned men who are ages old, and they are studying. They are learning the secrets of the. They're looking at porn. I don't know what to tell you.
So if what you're getting at is basically just that they're LARPer geeks who really have a lot of time on their hands, what you're saying is they're probably on Twitter and 4chan a lot.
I think they're AJ Gray. The Volturi is AJ Gray, and they're scanning the internet looking for nudie pictures that they can get away with putting on 411.
Crikey, fuck, let's hope not. That's almost as bad as saying they're Jeff Harris.
Aww. Oh, that wasn't nice.
Speaking of not nice, real quick wrap here on the original Twilight movie. It's the lightest of them all. You know, it's one of these that if they hadn't planned on doing, you know, there's a story about Lord of the Rings where I think New Line Cinema didn't want three movies. They initially just wanted one movie, and Peter Jackson fought and got his way. But, you know, if they had decided that they were just going to do one Twilight movie and not do all four books, this movie probably could have done okay on its own if they had just changed one or two things to give it more of a conclusive ending, because you knew there was going to be more after this. But
well, no, they didn't know, Mark. You didn't know that. They actually shot that one, and there was no guarantee they were going to do the rest of the series.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but... I know they kill the one vampire who is trying to eat Bella. But then that would have left a whole bunch of questions with the other two vampires.
Right, but that was the thing, that they weren't convinced that this was going to be the big sell that they thought it was, and it was costing a lot of money. So they didn't actually start shooting the second one until the first one had been released and had been a success.
No, I'm not arguing that point. What I'm saying is it's an odd choice then to have ended the movie the way they did. It left too many loose ends. I'm surprised it ends the way that it does, because if it had bombed and they weren't going to do any more, it would have been like, you know, Han getting frozen in carbonite and Darth Vader telling Luke Skywalker he's his father, and everyone going, okay, folks, that's it. That's the end of Star Wars. Wait a minute, what? You know, it wasn't quite that bad, but the end of it, you don't know what happens with her and Edward. You don't know where the other two vampires are that are now going to come back and, you know, avenge this one vampire that's been killed. It would have been an odd way to end that movie if there was nothing else that came after it. So it's an interesting bit of trivia that they weren't sure what they were going to do with this thing, and they still ended it that way. I guess they wanted to be pure to the book, or at least as pure as they could be, but it's still an odd choice.
You say that like that's not what we ended up with Hellboy.
Okay, fair enough. So that we can move on to New Moon and Eclipse in short order. Let's talk about some of the other things going on in this movie. Plot-wise, Bella is living with her biological mother. Biological mother is going on the road with stepdad, who is a AAA baseball player. And so Bella says, enough's enough. I'm going to go live in Seattle with Washington with my father, who is emotionally constipated himself.
She's punishing herself. She's doing it as a punishment.
Okay, now that's interesting, because that doesn't come across in the movie at all. Why is she punishing
herself? No, and that's all on Kristen Stewart, because truthfully, that was a big theme in the beginning of the book, is, and I know I keep going back to that, but you know, that was the thing, is she was doing it as a form of punishment to herself, because she didn't think she deserved happiness.
Yeah, that's a big failure on the writing of that movie. I can't even blame all Kristen Stewart on that, only because they never address it really in the movie.
It's a really throwaway scene. It's after the whole science throwdown with the microscope, when Edward decides, okay, I'm going to suck it up and deal with this person. They're having the whole conversation walking down the hallway, and he's like, why did you come, you know, if you don't like it here, why did you come here? And she basically alludes to, I was punishing myself.
Right. Again, that's a failure of writing then. Maybe she could have done something with it, but they're not giving her a whole lot to work with in terms of expressing that you're punishing yourself by doing this. But so she goes to live with the dad. She starts off in a new school. I thought the Anna Kendrick and the other actors who play the teenage school friends. Usually, you say this about younger actors. I'm going to say it about these folks, especially the male Asian kid. There are just times where like child actors are terrible and drag an entire movie down. It was just so pushy and so awkward. It was like watching Saved by the Bell. You know, it was
supposed to be like that.
Okay, mission accomplished. Because I cringed every time they were on screen, especially the one kid who, much to Sean's point, keeps going after Bella, and Bella cold shoulders him the entire time. Meanwhile, Anna Kendrick is practically, you know, dripping next to him, and it's written that he doesn't even pay any attention to this until Bella points it out to him. It's like, really? Wow.
Yeah, stupid. Son of a bitch.
But along the way, they introduce the Cullen family. She falls instantly in love with Edward. They spend a bit of the movie actually sort of antagonizing one another. There's a really funny bit there where she walks into the classroom, the fan blows wind, and then her the stink of her blood, I guess, blows into Edward, and he practically jumps through the fucking window to get away from her, which they'll explain
later. Which
is
one of my favorite things. I actually really like how that one was done, because that was almost play for play from the book, and it was actually really well done, because in the book they talked about how that did happen, and when she saw his reaction, she instantly became very self-conscious and wondered what was wrong with her. She actually wondered, did she smell? And so that was a really funny, awkward moment in the book also.
And so the next, like, hour of the movie is them kind of learning about each other and developing a relationship. And there's a scene in the movie where I kind of turned to you and jokingly said, and they spent all night talking. This is porn for women.
And it was. Because really all we want is a guy that's just going to listen to us blabber incessantly.
Yep, for hours on end. And that's how long I felt like that scene was. But I thought it was effective. It was effective in showing what it is she wants and what's good for her and him sort of being that for her. I can see why, as a man watching that, you want to cut your wrist. But as a woman, you're just like, see, why can't you be more like that, Sean?
Kids, allow me to backtrack a little bit and present to you the obvious reality check of the moment. When goddamn Stacey Pilgrim is right next to you, spinning her wheels in the mud in fifth gear and raring to go, by all rights, constant constipation right before your eyes should cease to exist.
And might I say, Anna Kendrick in her prom desk later on in one of these movies is boobalicious.
Oh, yeah. You know, word.
Well, that's why she put on the dress. It made her boobs look good.
You know what? And you talked about child actors in this movie. Let's give Anna Kendrick some credit. By the time Scott Pilgrim rolled around, she got better.
Anna Kendrick didn't bother me. It was the other three, especially the male Asian kid whose name I cannot recall, that drew that.
Oh,
that,
okay.
That
okay.
Ugh. Anna Kendrick
was. But that was how he was supposed to be. He's that, like, annoying. He's the annoying school editor of the paper.
Okay. He did. Then that's fine. Then his performance was spot on, and I have no problem with it. His character annoyed the living shit out of me, and I guess that's what he was supposed to do.
Yeah, that was kind of the thing with all those periphery characters. They were supposed to be those, you know, kind of awkward, oddball kids that you encounter in high school. And I actually thought they did a great job of being that, considering that they were all in their 20s.
So without rehashing a lot of the stuff we've already said about Pattinson and Stewart's acting, as he reveals to her that he's a vampire, and that's why he can't be with her and all of that. And this is after he saves her life from a car smushing her. There's a scene where he kind of goes almost to the other side of what your complaint was, Sean, where he was too emotionless. And this scene, he almost goes Jekyll and Hyde crazy, where he's jumping around in the trees, and he was like,
I'm
a monster. Yeah. And he's like, and she's of course not reacting at all. It's like when I was a kid and I was in the show, The Crucible, and I got, you know, girls running around on stage yelling, you know, there's witches everywhere and ghosts and spirits. And I'm just kind of sitting there staring off in the distance, and the director yells, hey, you react. How did that play for you, Sean? He's supposed to be basically scaring the shit out of her, and it's not working. She's not reacting, which is how it's written, but still, it just came across as very awkward to me.
Because this is the curse of this movie. It's not even like you're trying to play it to be intriguingly against expectation. It's just, you're having everybody react to things in either completely inappropriate ways or accepting some things way, way too easily for what a remarkable put is placed before them. It's, to be honest with you, it's almost like being in Times Square in New York and you're standing on the corner and you're having...
Turtle rolls past you?
hang on, let me finish. And you're having a slice and a cup of coffee on the corner, and it's you there as a tourist, like I myself would be, having never been to New York. And you're standing there with your friend, who is a longtime native New Yorker, veteran of the city. And along past you doing the cha-cha comes somebody dressed in a head-to-toe pink bunny suit, wielding a steel dildo that he is slapping up people upside the head with. You look on aghast, shocked, and frightened. And on the other hand, the person next to you, whom you're now staring at in equal amazement, just says, "Huh, is it Tuesday?" "Huh, bunny suit man, dildo, yeah, it must be Tuesday. Hey, I got dry cleaning I got to pick up. We'll catch up. I'll catch up with you later." That's about what it's like. You're watching this as the audience, and this is true later when we get to the om nom nom on the placenta scene. And everybody else that you're looking at on screen is just kind of sitting there just going, "Huh. Nothing? That's it?" That's the entire movie. And this scene is a microcosm of that.
I think, you know, Kristen Stewart, as you're saying, accepts Edward as a vampire way too much, way too soon. And I don't know if it's like that in the book or not, but there are certain things that take away from these movies that make them weaker than they could have been. And that's one of those things where, yes, we need to get to a point where she's madly in love with him to the exclusion of all else, but it didn't have to be in that moment. You know, it's kind of having your dessert before dinner. And I don't know, it bothered me, and it's one of those things that definitely takes me out of the movie.
It was definitely rushed.
Yeah. And as I said before, that's a structural problem where they're just trying to cram as much stuff into this movie as possible, and so the pacing is off. Because we have to address it, because it becomes a major plot point over the next two movies, is, you know, they're dating, she becomes accepted into the family, she meets Emmett, Daddy Cullen, Mommy Cullen, whose names I cannot remember, Jasper and Alice, and, you know, Alice falls instantly in love with her, too. Rosalie hates her guts, and Jasper tries to eat her.
Can we just point out, we have a vampire named Jasper?
We also have a
Jasper.
Vampire named Emmett.
And Rosalie, and
yeah, but, you know, there's something about a certain matching up between name and character. I mean, a vampire named Rosalie...
They couldn't all
be
Vladimir.
Okay, that kind of fits. A vampire named Edward Cullen. Okay, something about that. Yeah, that kind of fits. That kind of syncs up. On the other hand, then we have the vampire named Jasper, who was supposedly sired at one point during a migratory trek through Alabama.
The only thing that would have made that better is if the Emmett vampire was also playing it in a jug band at Christmas time for his mother.
And it was
with
an honor.
The hole in the wash tub. It was an honor.
Oh.
All right, so.
Well, then again, you know, WWE did once have a vampire named Kevin.
That's true. In the interest of time, she ends up meeting these other three vampires, and this causes one of the other vampires to try to eat her, and he becomes the big villain of this thing. And in the end, they end up killing him as he grievously injures Bella, setting up sort of a blood feud between his mate, who is two different actresses. The character's name is Victoria, over the next two movies. So let's put Twilight to bed, and let's move on to New Moon. unless there's something you got a burning desire to say something about that movie, Melissa, do you?
No, no.
Okay, Sean?
Nope.
Good, New Moon. So in New Moon, Edward, almost at the onset of it, has decided, that's it. After everything that's happened in the last movie, and with the presence of Victoria still out there, here's a good idea. We'll just get the fuck out of town, and Victoria won't bother you anymore. So there's this breakup scene, which I don't want to keep repeating the same thing. So suffice it to say, there was a lot of emotion, potential emotion that could have been seen when he leaves Bella the first time, and it's just not there. Again, it's more like she stepped in dog shit. But he's gone, and this is where I want to focus, because this and the stuff with the wolves is probably the two most interesting things about New Moon. Film is about capturing things moving, okay? Things are supposed to be moving in film. It's not radio. Film is a visual medium, folks. So when you're deciding that you're going to capture depression, you really have to be creative in how you're going to do that so that you can keep people's interest. And in this movie, they chose to leave Bella in a chair with the hoodie and have the camera do a 360-degree pan around her as the seasons change and title credits come up that show you what month they're in. And for about 4 months pass by, as she apparently never gets out of this chair, and that's how they show you depression. Melissa, you and I have talked about that.
I thought it was an interesting choice,
but tell me why you like that.
I actually liked it because I thought that it kind of showed how she stopped. One of the big thematic kind of things was when he left her, her life ended. That's how she felt. And she completely shut down from the world. And I thought that was a really good way of showing that, of like, here is this person where the rest of the world is moving around her and they're going on, and she's stopped.
Okay. And visually, you were okay with it? You didn't feel like it took you out of the movie or it was boring or just stops the movie cold?
No, I didn't think so. But I knew that they were going to have to show that somehow. You know, I have prior knowledge because I've read the book. So I knew they were going to have to show this kind of stopping in her life. And in fact, in the book, how they did it in the book is you actually have completely blank pages that just say months on them.
I'm going to publish an entire book of blank pages and call it The Depression.
It'll win prizes, I'm sure.
Yes, and the Nobel Prize in Literature goes to. All right, mm-hmm. Sean. From a cinematic point of view, and you know, as somebody whose only reference point is these movies and is looking for stuff on screen to happen, how did that work for you?
That shot raises all kinds of questions about what was going on with her hygiene and whether or not anybody said anything.
I guess it took you out of the movie and it was not believable.
Nor was it believable that she somehow managed to send several dozen emails to Edward's sister and never caught the several dozen repeated notifications that they all bounced back.
She didn't give a shit.
That was like her way of trying to cope with everything. She knew they were bouncing back. She just kept doing it.
Get a live journal, you silly bent.
No, these books are post-live journal. Live journal was dead at this point.
Okay, do what everybody else does. Get Twitter.
start a podcast.
That's the even more disturbing prospect, is the fact that she knew they were getting bounced back. She just didn't care. It's like she thought, well, the system has refused to deliver 36, maybe 37.
She was hoping against hope, Sean. She What else was she going to do? Her world was over. She might as well be dead. This was the message in a bottle sent at sea. Don't you understand the pain this woman is going through?
You're also a goddamn teenager and a reasonably attractive one.
It didn't matter.
She had people still going after her.
I'm sorry, honey, those pants are not going to be vacant of manly hands very long.
It didn't matter. The only manly hands that mattered were Edward's.
It's just, and granted, yes, I know that teenage girls have a profound sense of this is the worst thing ever. But my God, this was just taking it to absolutely comical lengths.
It sounds like, in all seriousness, because we're having some fun with this, but it does sound like, you know, if here is the character that's supposed to be the anchor for this thing, in your eyes, it made her less sympathetic.
It really did, and more so, it made me wonder if, number one, if anybody around her had happened to say to her, you know, you're in your teens. Everything is not ruined forever. And
this is what made me mad about this movie the most, though, is because they left out some really big pieces from the book that were really important. Like the fact that one of the guys from the school, Mike, the kind of nerdy white guy, his family owned a sporting goods store. And one of the things she did was started working at the sporting goods store, and her and Mike developed a really close relationship, which is kind of sets up the whole movie theater scene. So that's what drove, you know, that would be kind of my complaint about that scene, is because they did leave off some of the things that were happening for her.
Okay, see, now that makes sense. That actually makes a little more sense from a character standpoint. And I really can't quite fathom why you wouldn't adapt that to the movie to make the character at least a little more engaging and a little less irritating, or a little less watch at the very least.
I think they thought it was going to be this like dramatic thing, you know, and it fell short of what they wanted.
You know, I want to keep coming back to this. I wonder also if it's a gender thing. You know, as men, we see it one way, and it causes us to have less sympathy for our hero. But as women, it goes, no, that makes complete sense. No, I'm right there with her. I'm more sympathetic.
But my question then becomes, though, the director of this one was a man. So
well, that's an even more interesting question then. You know, is this how men see women seeing women and trying to portray that? I mean, Twilight is a really funny series because of the kinds of stuff that we were saying before, where you have this sort of built-in audience of teenage girls and in some cases middle-aged women, and it almost doesn't know what it wants to be because it's trying to be something for everybody when it's not what it was ever meant to be. So you know, rather than getting a woman to direct the goddamn thing, because, you know, it'll be the easiest way to get the stuff translated from book to screen to screen, you have a man in there. It's like Sex and the City, you know, where it was like, this isn't. Oh God, what was the line that was said about that? It was like it's written for gay men or something like that, not actually women. I can't remember it, so I'm really mauling that whole comparison.
But the interesting thing, the first one was done by a female. So the first one was a female, and then the rest of them were all men.
And it feels like it. Now that you mention it, I was trying to put my finger on what it was that was off about these, and that's probably it. Sean, you were about to say something?
Yeah, allow me to ask what's probably going to sound like kind of a silly question. What Melissa mentioned about the books, how Bella's portrayed as, you know, getting a job, striking up a friendship and kind of a closeness with another guy after Edward departs, that to me, and I say this, you know, all kind of inflated snark aside, that is what you do when a major relationship ends. Sometimes you're just going through the motions. Sometimes it's all just an act. Sometimes it's an act that just convinces you. I speak from fairly recent experience. But that is what you do. You go out there and and you at least go through it at half speed. That makes a little more sense. That's a little more realistic, and to me, that would be something that would be a little more engaging to watch. It would get me a little more involved with the character. But if this movie is kind of supposed to be somewhat of almost an idealization of love and relationships, is the point this misguided director trying to make here that somehow he thinks that the idealization of love and rather the end of a relationship is essentially shutting a woman, shutting herself off from the world?
The end of that woman's life.
Yeah, and just everything just comes to a full dead stop, purgatory.
That could be like the male centric piece, though, where you know here's a guy who thinks that when a girl has been in this earth-moving relationship and it ends, you know, like oh well, clearly her life ended too. So I mean, maybe that is the male perspective because that's really not how it went down in the book.
Well, I think it's the male perspective of what they think women are thinking, which is probably why these films come off a little convoluted emotionally. I think this is a man kind of sitting down and thinking, okay, women think that when the love of their life leaves them, they should just kill themselves, like some sort of Indian bride who immolates herself after the husband dies. So that's what we'll do on screen. That'll make women love these things. And, what was your reaction to that, Melissa?
I understood what was happening. I just didn't, I didn't love it. I mean, but again, it goes back to I had prior knowledge. I knew that there was other stuff that was happening. And I remember being kind of like, hey, wait, they're leaving out some stuff here.
Right. I guess what I was asking you is, do you feel like if that's what the director thinks women are all about, was that fair or unfair?
I think that's inaccurate.
Okay.
Yeah.
To the point about, you develop other friendships, you try to fall back and regroup. They took everything, kind of like Lord of the Rings, where they gave a lot of Tom Bombadil, whatever his name was, lines and gave it to the Ents. They took a lot of that stuff that they gave that is her friendship with the one kid and gave it all to Jacob. That's the friend that she develops after the breakup. That's the person that she goes to try to get her life back in order. Once she starts to, once the dad pretty much threatens to send her to Jacksonville, and she starts to figure out that if she nearly dies, Edward will show up to say, "What are you, an idiot?" So that's the whole second part of the movie, is them developing this relationship, and then that gets impeded by the fact that he turns into a wolf at some point. We spent a lot of time talking about the wolf lore and all of that. I don't want to spend the next hour discussing the ins and outs of wolves. Suffice it to say, again, These are fictional ideas, and an author has a right to take them in any direction that they want. You can like them or dislike them, but this was her concept, and I was okay with it. So that being said, just real quick, was there anything, Sean, you wanted to say about the rest of the wolf pack? Kevin Nash,
the
Conan.
The wolves are cussy puppies.
Melissa, anything on the wolf?
No, nothing.
Okay. And then they also spend a fair amount of time also dealing with Victoria, who was sort of out there looming around, trying to figure out how she was going to get to Bella. Now she has to put up with the wolves protecting her. I don't remember how they resolved it in the second film. You want a quick film? Okay. It was just they kept chasing her. They kept chasing her out of Washington, and she kept saying, "Curses, I'll get you, my pretty, if it's the last thing I do." Is that about right?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay. Edward comes back, and again, this is very much a play on Romeo and Juliet. Edward thinks she's dead, so he decides he's going to go to the Volturi and expose himself as a vampire. you know, real quick, just so, because, you know, Sean, I always set you up so that you can do your little Sean rants. I shouldn't say little. That's condescending. So that you can do your bombastic Sean rants that are entertaining. I'm going to do this one for my wife just because I've heard her do it before, and it's one of the few bits she does that's pretty hysterical. Melissa, what happens when the vampires go into sunlight?
Oh, Jesus. That goddamn sound. I just go over that sound. Like, I don't have issue with the sparkle, okay? I don't. That doesn't bother me. I thought it was a little odd that vampires sparkled. But seriously, to add a sound effect that then they go tinkle, 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 tinkle. No, that is the most ridiculous thing on the planet. Like,
so they're not just vampire fairies. I thought we had this discussion already.
Yeah, apparently.
They are one part Dracula.
Vampires aren't scary. They make noises and they sparkle.
Ladies and gentlemen, they're not vampires. They're walking disco balls. Don't you understand what's happening here?
I was actually really happy when they took, because the first movie it was really bad, and they dropped the sound for the next couple, and then they brought it back.
Yep. Well, I think when she turns into a vampire and walks out into the sunlight, they bring back the...
She makes the noise.
Yeah, the disco jingle. So that's what he's going to do. He's going to walk into the sunlight and perform YMCA for all the Italians. And that's the plan to get himself killed. And she has to then go to Italy to stop him and say, look, I'm not dead, you asshole. And... Then she ends up meeting the Volturi, and that's what they introduce. Those people who basically tell them, either turn the bitch into a vampire or you're all dead. And they say, well, let's wait till she finishes high school. What do you think about that? And
oh,
they were like,
oh, the perpetually bored-sounding Volturi.
They're not bored. They're old. Don't you understand? They've been around. My favorite one is one that's like been around since the time of Jesus. And when he died... Yeah, and when he allegedly dies in the last movie, that was my favorite part of that whole thing. As ridiculous as the last fight scene is, that was my favorite. Just him going, finally, and the two, and he gets killed. They do total elimination on him. Cronus hits him low, Parry Saturn hits him high, and he's dead. It was fantastic.
But again, I love that. These are vampires, vampire royalty. That take sounding perpetually bored with everything. They are being constantly unamused, bored vampire LARPers.
Not Aro. Aro thought everything was funny.
No, but that's my point. They managed to actually be more entertaining, more interesting than two out of our three lead characters.
Yeah, I think Aro needs his own movie. Where he tries to take on Gotham City.
Again, I just want a movie that takes place in the throne room before anybody walks in. I want to see what they're doing.
So that's New Moon. I think it's funny. I'm actually looking. I whenever we do these podcasts, I always keep open the Wikipedia page in case I have to look at notes real quick. And I was looking at the Rotten Tomatoes aggregates and Metacritic aggregates. Yeah. New Moon, 28% based on 218 reviews on Rotten Tomatoes.
It is the worst of them all. It really is.
Not according to Rotten Tomatoes. The worst of them all is Breaking Dawn Part 1. But it's up there. It's close. Yeah, New Moon is a... I wish we almost had like a panel of women, because I'm curious to see what more women thought of New Moon, considering its mopey demeanor... and it's sort of, you know, dealing with a broken heart and the effect that has on you, either badly or well, depending on, you know, your taste in movies, I guess. I'd be curious to see what more women. I mean, Melissa, you talked to like Sarah, hi wife, and other people who have seen. I mean, did everyone kind of universally think it stunk?
I don't remember truthfully. Is that the one that Sarah saw with us, or did she see the next one with us?
Or do you not
remember at all?
No, I don't remember.
Okay, I don't remember.
I know one of them we saw twice, because we saw one of them with Ken.
Yeah, I think it's the next one. Yeah, I don't remember anyone actually. I know everyone saw it, but I don't remember anyone actually discussing it afterwards, which makes me leads me to think that people are like, I hope they improve on the next one.
Interesting, though, this is the least like an action movie. Because, again, tonally it's all over the place and they can't make up their minds what it is they want to be. This was and again, I wouldn't necessarily call it a romance movie. It was more about breaking up than it was romance. But it was thematically, tonally, it was sort of the weirdest movie out of all of them. There's no action. There's no climactic action scene other than she runs to go stop him from killing himself. Ultimately, you know, it's almost a tragedy.
Well, maybe this was the one they should have skipped.
You think so?
Maybe.
Or maybe, you know, they should have combined New Moon and Eclipse.
I'm curious, because I don't remember this from any other vampire movie or book or comic I've ever read. Where does it enter equation that for the sunlight to kill the vampire has to be naked?
Oh, that's not what would have killed him. But that's not what would have killed him.
It's not the sunlight that would have killed him, right? What she's saying is he took his shirt off so that everyone could see him sparkle, which I don't understand why he thought that was going to work either. It was Italy. They would have assumed he was disco dancing.
Yeah, I was going to say, people go around starkers in Italy all the time.
I was going to say, he walks up, takes his shirt off, he starts to sparkle and tinkle, and people would have been like, yeah, young man, you know, it was great.
Hey, mamma mia, that's the guy, he does his tacker.
Yeah, they would have just started raving.
Look at that, the shiny penis.
Yes. Let's move on. So that's New Moon, in a nutshell. Then we get to the point where the vampires pick up arms and they challenge Sauron. No, what happens here in Eclipse is, I'm not kidding. The producers of the producers of this thing really must have sat around going, look, Lord of the Rings was popular. Big fight scenes and stuff. We need you know what's missing in romance movies? Large climactic fight scenes. That's what we want, is the armies. We want to see, you know, we want to see Jessica Parker leading an army of people in high heels and swords. That's what the women want. Do you have that image now of Sarah Jessica Parker leading an army?
Vaguely, yeah. Everybody's in Jimmy Choo's wolf chomping across the field.
It'd be fantastic. But that's what you get with Eclipse. Victoria has a great plan. She is the redheaded vampire trying to kill Bella being responsible for killing her mate. And she couldn't get to Bella in the second film, no matter how hard she tried. So in this one, she's going to create an army of newborns. She picks a guy who was local to Forks, who happens to be in Seattle, and she says, "Hey, run around and bite the shit out of people, and then, you know, go to Forks and try to kill this person, and take out any other vampire that's around her at the time." And this is where you get to know more of the Cullens. They take some time in Eclipse because now Bella and Edward are together, and I think what was established at the end of New Moon was they're going to get married at some point. So this movie kind of, you know, is the bridge to getting to all of that and her eventual turn. But along the way, they still have to deal with this giant problem, and that is there's a vampire out to kill Bella. This is the movie where they actually take some time and do Rosalie's story and Jasper's story, and you get to know some of these other people as actual characters and not sort of window dressing on this romance between Bella and Edward. So let's take a minute and just talk about that. You and I like Jasper. Melissa, what's Jasper's role?
Yeah, I do. I really like Jasper.
What's the deal with Jasper?
You mean, like, with his story?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, he was a Confederate soldier, and he happened to stumble upon a group of women who he thought were distressed, and turns out they were vampires, and they bit him, and he actually then trained newborns to go and take over territories so that his you know, his mate at that time, they could expand their territory and have places to hunt. And he found out he was being used, and he left, and then he found Alice. But he's a good Southern gentleman. I love him. I actually really, I like that character.
What I found fun with Jasper was he was, I guess, the youngest member of the newest member of the family. So
yes,
he was the one struggling with the taste of human blood. So there's a great line, you know, when in one of the early movies where she decides she wants to be a vampire and they all have the family vote, and he goes, "It'll be nice not wanting to kill you for once." The other character, and I don't know if I remember if it's this movie or the next one, but you also learn Rosalie's story. And Rosalie was dating a young man, and he gets drunk one night and ends up with a gang of other guys raping and, I guess, killing her, or leaving her for dead.
Almost killing her.
Yeah.
Yeah, leaving her for dead.
And what is the main vampire's name, the main Colin?
Carlisle.
And, you know, Carlisle saves her, turns her more or less against her will, as she points out over and over and over and over again. And then she takes revenge on this guy and all of the people that attacked her, and then becomes part of this family. So Sean, just real quick, your thoughts on Rosalie?
I would agree. Of the side characters, she's one of the more interesting ones in the movie. She gets some development, gets a few good lines here and there. She's just a generally pretty good foil for Bella. Hell, actually, should have probably just—I dare say—just swapped the cast. Maybe should have just had the actress playing Rosalie playing Bella in the first place. Would have definitely made her more watchable, even if maybe it's not exactly how you pictured her looking thanks to the book.
But it would have been very Hollywood.
God knows we'd have to swap on that one.
I said it would have been very Hollywood, though. So we have supposed to be this mousy brunette. Nope, we're going to go with the buxom blonde. That'll be fantastic. More people.
It's kind of like how,
let's see here. Big guy, heavy set, kind of fat, bald, white, dresses in inexpensive suits. Gives Daredevil all kinds of trouble. Michael Clark Duncan.
But that Nikki Reed, the girl who played Rosalie, they actually dyed her hair blonde. She's a natural brunette. I think she's like Hispanic or something. But yeah, she was a brunette. And it's one of those, like, you know, there's always the fun trivia on things like IMDb. But it took like 3 hours for them to dye her hair blonde for the first movie. So then as the movies went on, they actually created hair pieces for her and stopped dyeing her hair blonde. So she is a brunette.
This is the stunning thing. There are good actors in this movie. Just almost none of them, with the exception of Taylor Lautner, are playing leads.
I really do feel like they miscast it. And actually, I misspoke. Kristen Stewart always had the part. It was Robert Pattinson who they hadn't decided on. So Kristen Stewart, apparently, from pretty much day one, was the one who was supposed to be Bella.
And they should have gone with the cat with the person who played Rosalie.
Well, and you know what? Even in this movie, I think they continued it because, Victoria had this great plan to kill Bella. Unfortunately, she also had the terrible plan to stop being Rachelle LaFave and start being Bryce Dallas Howard.
Right. Does anybody actually know why the original girl got canned?
You know what? I was actually just looking that up on Wikipedia a little bit ago because I couldn't remember the name of the original actress. I just knew that she was on Big Wolf on Campus.
You know what would have been funny is if they had pulled a Roseanne and they actually brought the old Victoria in at the end of the movie and they, you know, just would have looked at each other.
Nice.
and then Robert Pattinson says, "What are you doing here?"
All I know about it is I believe that the studio claimed, I believe that it was either scheduling conflicts or budget reasons, but Rachelle was supposedly completely blindsided by being taken out and was actually pretty dismayed at it. Probably in no small part because Bryce Dallas Howard was offered the role in the first place
and turned it down.
She thought it was too small for her. She didn't want it. But,
you know, these are movies that were plagued with scheduling conflicts because the first director, the reason she didn't direct the second one is a scheduling conflict.
Right, right. But, you know, quite frankly, I thought that I loved Rochelle as Victoria in the first two movies. I thought she was great. I thought Bryce was a big downgrade, actually, even if it was just for one movie.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you say that because I thought the character has more to do in the third one. She's the main villain. She's actually doing villainous things. You know, she's goading the one idiot vampire to do her bidding for her. She has the final climactic scene with Edward at the end of the movie. I thought she was fine. I didn't necessarily miss the former actress, and I thought she handled the part well. What is your gripe exactly?
I just thought that Rochelle brought a little more personality to it.
She has almost nothing to do in the first movie. In the second movie, she spends most of it running, and then the only time she gets to do something is when she's a different human being.
Well, yeah, I know, but even she kind of, I guess you could say she kind of made the most of her minutes, so to speak, in what was really a part with not very much screen time in the second movie. But in the first movie, I like
her.
She
did have killer delivery on the one with the wicked curveball delivery. I will say that.
Yes, I'm with you on that one. It's not like that. This was a big game changer for the entire movie necessarily, but I didn't really think that bringing in Bryce Dallas Howard instead was a big improvement either. That's just my thought, though.
Okay. So, Melissa, refresh my memory here. I know that this is the graduation movie. This is the one where Anna Kendrick actually gives a really good graduation speech, which sort of sets the tone of the movie and some of the themes that they're dealing with. I know the speech itself really speaks to Bella about making sure that I think this is the one where they're dealing with the decision for her to become a vampire is more real because she's and this is also the one where she wants to be a vampire, but she doesn't necessarily want to marry Edward because she's got some issues with the concept of marriage. And so they're in sort of conflict about that, correct?
Yes, yes.
And
yeah, she's just kind of anti-marriage.
And she's anti-marriage because?
Her parents. She's the product of divorce, and it was this concept of marriage is bad.
Okay, and meanwhile, Edward is from, you know, a time where And before I even say that, she comes to a conclusion at some point in the movie that she wants to have sex with Edward, and he's like, hey, never mind wanting to be a vampire. I also don't want to have sex before marriage. So there's was this the one also where she's dealing with age and age is a big problem for her?
Yes, this is the one. Yes.
Okay.
Well, it's not as big of a deal as it is in the first one, but she's like, I don't want to age another year. Like, the second one is the one where it's her birthday and she's, like, freaking out about it.
Right.
This is the one where she just starts to kind of say things like, you know, I don't need to age another year and things like that.
Right. So there's a lot of pressure on Edward to turn her, and he keeps trying to – first of all, he's very concerned for her soul. Let's just real quick, because I want to make sure it got addressed. There's a lot about soul in this movie, in this series, and the concept of if you're a vampire, you're soulless. But there's a religious element to this where the soul is important, and the vampire is part of the reason why they struggle with their immortality is the loss of their soul. And so everyone's protective of Bella's soul, and she could give a shit less. Let me hear some of your thoughts on that first, Melissa, and then Sean.
It's kind of one of those secondary things. I think I thought it was an interesting adaptation. I think Stephenie Meyer and the writers of these were really trying to kind of covertly encourage morality, and I thought it was an interesting way of trying to kind of present the concepts to girls.
I thought it was interesting that they finally had time in the movies to do that, considering the prior two movies they had so much stuff going on. It was hard to take the time to sort of do some serious examination of thematic elements. Sean, Soul.
You know what? They tried, but again, it's an interesting concept to take on. Like I said before, Interview with the Vampire, it kind of did it in a pretty interesting way. Bram Stoker's Dracula, meaning, of course, the Francis Ford Coppola movie, not necessarily the novel, also did that and kind of did that in a really intriguing, engaging way. Buffy arguably did it the best anything ever has or ever will, but unfortunately, God love them, they tried, but the performers in this movie just were not up to really carrying it off. And at this point, all that's managed to happen is Bella has managed, or I should say Kristen Stewart has managed to cement Bella over the course of three movies as just a vapid, deplorable little twat. So things like, I don't need to age another year, it just comes off as more eye-rolling posturing and just more screw everybody else, what about me?
She definitely does come across as self-centered.
Yeah, I mean, face it, folks, there's rational self-interest, and then there's just snarkily wanting to ask her, gee, do you have to duck your head when you see the world starting to revolve around you?
There's a single-mindedness to her character that can be grating.
It never stops being grating.
Well, no, like, okay, and I guess let's talk about the final conclusion of all of this so that we can get into Breaking Dawn 1 and 2, because boy, is there stuff to talk about. And we're into the recorded portion of our podcast here, so we've got another a little less than an hour to get through all of this. Again, less if we get it all done. But I wanted to make sure there was time to get these two movies in. I love the end of Eclipse. I love a good fight scene.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Vampires fighting each other. I thought the way they did it was fun. You know, all things considered, it was a bunch of supermen punching each other in the face, basically. They had the wolves there. The wolves have, the wolves are doing their part to protect humanity. So they had a vested interest in this particular battle.
This is where they lost me.
Okay.
This is where, for me, I was like, oh, I'm so annoyed right now.
Real quick, and I don't want to do a long diatribe on it, but the book, does it make a big deal out of this final fight scene, or was this something done?
No, there is no final fight scene in the book.
Oh.
There is no fight in the book.
What do the army of vampires do in the book?
In the book, they witness. They are witnesses to that this is
in
not
Eclipse?
An immortal child.
No, I'm talking about Eclipse.
Oh, sorry. that was the fight.
Okay.
Sorry, I was moving ahead. You started talking about Breaking Dawn, so I went to Breaking Dawn. Sorry.
Nope, still on Eclipse. All right, so the movie got it right. There is a final.
The movie got it right.
Okay, fantastic.
No, I have no complaints over. I have zero complaints over how Eclipse ended. I really liked it.
Yeah. So the army, the newborn army, clashes with the Cullens and the Wolves, and most of them get their ass kicked. The Volturi, I think the Volturi show up to kill one of the newborns at the very end of it. Victoria has a clash with Edward. Edward, I think, ends up killing her, and everything is resolved. And in all honesty, give me 30 more minutes of Bella getting married, getting pregnant, having the baby, being turned, and the movie just ends with her opening her eyes and she's a vampire. I would have been happy. You know, give me the Lord of the Rings multiple endings in just that third movie. I'm good with this. Don't need Breaking Dawn 1 and 2. That final fight scene, good enough for me. But alas, that is not the end. Jacob is still fighting the whole concept of her turning into a vampire for some odd reason, because he doesn't get the hint. And we move into Breaking Dawn. Now we're on Breaking Dawn, Melissa. You with me?
Yes, now I'm with you.
Okay. Now we move into Breaking Dawn. Very quickly we get to they get married. The concept of her becoming a vampire is becoming she's almost there. They don't know at the time that, having sex will produce an immortal child. It's just sort of something they figure out along the way. So they go, they get married, they have their honeymoon period. Let me break there and just sort of get you guys back in with this. The wedding and then the subsequent scenes of their honeymoon. They have sex. He bruises her all over the place. She thinks it's the greatest thing ever.
He breaks the bed. You're missing the most important part. He breaks the bed.
He breaks the bed, right.
That's
it's
a
so
big
good.
Deal. That
off
is such
camera,
a big deal.
He breaks the bed.
That is such a big deal. Like, in girl circles, I don't know why, but I think for so many of us, like, that scene and the bed breaking was, like, something we had to see visually because we'd read about it and we'd devoured this book, and it's like that was the thing. You wanted to see that.
No, I'm glad we're on the same page. I'm glad we're on the same page with that.
Hang on, Sean. Hang on. I gotta press her on this, and then you can go. But why? That's something
I don't know.
Fine, but why is him breaking the bed? The sex is
there's
so good. How good is it? I mean, why? Why is it
there's
important?
Something. It's that. It's just that. This was. I don't know. It was. I don't know why. I don't know what it is for a girl.
Does the
where it's
bed
like that
represent her virginity?
Of,
does the bed represent her virginity? Is her vagina?
No,
what's happening here?
The bed is representative of just sex that is that damn good. Every girl wants to experience that. Every girl, you want to go through the thing where the guy is so overcome with you that he breaks the bed.
All right. I'll keep that in mind. But, I may have to do it with, a sledgehammer or something, just keep that in mind. When the cops show up, Melissa, I'm quoting you now. I have you on record. She told me to break the bed, not with a chainsaw, you asshole. Okay, Sean, you're
right. Anyway.
Come here, alcohol. I
might need to join you on that one.
Melissa, you don't have my upstairs neighbors. I have to listen to that shit at least 3 or 4 times a week. hell, Mark has seen
door.
My Facebook.
You should knock on their door one day.
Mark has seen my Facebook
statuses.
There actually was one morning where in the slight days of first waking up, I heard rhythmic pounding and thought somebody was doing roofing work on my building. Then I hear,
oh, God.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, I'm not kidding. It sounds like a chimp being sodomized upstairs.
Oh, no.
And occasionally, I shit you not here. Occasionally, I swear I have heard her let out a Xena war yell. It's brief, but I swear I have heard it. That and horsey noises.
Oh, God. I definitely am glad I don't live at your place.
I have thought about leaving a note on their door saying, food for thought. I record 3 podcasts a month. Next time, I'm going to leave you a link if my internal mic ever picks up your spontaneous humpity bumpity.
So back to the bed breaking and the subsequent scenes of Edward refusing to touch Bella and Bella trying to awkwardly seduce him. Sean, your thoughts on that entire sequence?
my thoughts on that entire sequence.
By the way, I love it when I always think it's very sexy, and it gets me going when a woman walks in with lingerie and then proceeds to go to sleep. That's what gets my goat going. Let me tell you what, you know, whoever wrote that scene definitely knows the mindset of men and how to get them rolling.
Oy. Yeah, does she happen to be cognizant of perhaps some kind of rape kink maybe that Edward has that we're not made privy to? That's all I can think of.
When you plan that, like, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to put on lingerie and then go into bed and then take a nap, and I hope she sticks me in the butt. That's what I'm looking for here. Strange things in your butt. That's what's going to make this different for me.
Apparently the best part of waking up is cold, undead dick up your ass. Oh, years of coffee commercials, you've lied to me.
The best part of waking up is Edward in your butt. You're welcome.
Hang on, I need to grab a new bottle. Come here, Heartland Red. You understand my pain.
That's going to be that is going to be my only description on this podcast. Is the best part of waking up is Edward in your butt. Enjoy.
Most views ever, and also probably best 411 comments ever. but I said, but anyway. Yeah, Beavis over. No, it's the most hilariously awkward sex montage I have ever seen in anything.
It's definitely cold looking, and the funniest part to me is that those two are supposed to, you know, they're really dating in real life, and they're getting married in real life, and here you have these scenes, and you're looking at it, and you're just like, oh my god, they look like they're afraid to even, like, go near each other.
I was really interested to see that, and then, yeah, I'm with you on the bed thing. I don't get why so many directors have a hard time with this, even though you're going for a PG-13 rating here. Show, don't tell. Why is this so difficult? Why is this such an elusive concept? It just takes so much away. And I'm not even someone who read the books. And even I thought, okay, it's very clear to me that there has to be so much more here. I refuse to believe that that's the way Stephanie Meyer wrote it.
It's not even close, because there's so much, like, there's so much sexual tension. You've gone through now three books prior to this of this tension building between them, because she has actually kind of pressed for things throughout all of the books. Mm-hmm. And so for it to finally go down, and the whole idea with that bed breaking was just that emotional buildup and him trying to hold back and not hurt her, but being so... you know, just excited by the moment, and he snaps the bed. I mean, like, it's the ultimate in sexual tension. It was awesome in the book.
And you know what? To draw kind of a comparison, what the sad part about the whole PG-13 thing, and I realize why they did it. I get it. I understand that. But still, the part about it that's so genuinely sad is the fact that if I had to pick a style to kind of bite for those scenes, I'm thinking almost any of the love scenes from any season of Dexter would have been just about perfect. That, I think, would have been just a perfect tone for that. That would have gotten across precisely what you need, particularly anything from the second season or the seventh season. That would have been great. But instead, unfortunately, what you get is you get an arc of this movie that goes from this tepid, awkward letdown of a sexual sequence to what is pretty much an uneventful middle part of the movie that just
not eventful for you. Have you ever been through pregnancy? My goodness.
Okay,
that's
fine.
Not an accurate representation of pregnancy, okay? Speaking
it was
as
for
someone
me.
Who has gone through it.
It was for me, damn it.
Really, Mark, is it an accurate representation of pregnancy when the baby pretty much goes straight Brock Lesnar on mommy's innards?
Actually, I was
certain
in the
women, but...
Listen, I was in the delivery room when Lily was born, and I'm pretty sure she F5'd herself. You're welcome.
Oh, I think you're right. That Mark is Cody's mustache.
And down goes the port.
For those who don't know, in case you were wondering, last night during Money in the Bank, I taught my daughter to chant Cody's mustache. And earlier this evening, she led us in a glorious chanting of Cody's mustache, complete with bow and thank you. That's my kid, yo.
Parenting,
yes.
You are doing it damn well, sir.
Parenting.
But, yeah, I mean, the baby almost killing Bella and, you know, and sapping all of her blood and breaking her bones, that was kind of like what Melissa went through with Lily, as I recall.
Well, but here's the thing, though, and I have to give him credit for this much, and I'm going to kind of weave this in here. You go from that really disappointing sequence that had to be even more disappointing for anybody who read the books, through a middle part of the movie that is, okay, you didn't like uneventful, I'll just say it, flat-out boring, with the exception of the fact that I have to give a world of credit to the people who did Bella's makeup, or who did Kristen Stewart's makeup. They did a good job making it look like the Crypt Keeper. Yeah, they really did a top-notch job of transforming her throughout that middle section. That was really commendable. And then you get to the, what I'm sure we'll get to shortly, the absolutely hysterical ending.
Let me interject here. What I remember of that was, and I don't remember where exactly I read it, but I was reading people comment about what Breaking Dawn had to be. And I remember a lot of women were writing on the internet, on boards or wherever, comment sections, et cetera, that the birthing scene had to be the bloodiest, grossest thing they've ever captured on film. Because I guess that's the way it is in the book.
It was very graphic in the book.
Yeah, anything short of rated R, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street, Aliens, you know, face hugger kind of a thing. You know, it had to be that level of gross in order for it to work.
Because how the baby was brought into this world was literally Edward ripped open her stomach with his teeth. That was the only thing that would cut through.
Well, there wasn't a sterile knife present, as I recall.
No, there was, but what happened is the uterus, the sac, the embryo, this is getting technical now, the embryonic sac that was holding the baby was like stone, like vampire skin. So the only way he could get through it, the knife wouldn't go through it, the only way he could do it was to rip it with his teeth.
They really should have done more of that. I didn't get that at all. What they should have done is, like, they try to cut it with a knife, the knife breaks. You know, they tried to get it with a larger knife, that breaks. They get a chainsaw, the chainsaw breaks. Somebody pulls a sword off the wall, that breaks. You know, and finally, oh, just use your teeth. That would have – I think that's the way they should have done that scene.
But it was written in a very graphic way.
Yeah. And actually, I didn't think what made the screen was really all that bad.
No, I didn't either, but I do know last night that our daughter was still up while we were watching it, and as soon as I saw the cup of blood hit the floor, I grabbed her and took her to the bedroom because that was one thing I didn't feel like a two-year-old needed to see.
Well, yeah, I mean, two-year-old standards, that's understandable.
Well, there was a scene like that in Tinkerbell and the Lost Treasure. Never mind. but seriously,
yeah,
folks... The question is, did that scene live up to your expectations, Melissa, and I guess the collective expectations of people who read the book?
I don't think it did. I think that breaking down part one and part two, you have a series of events that never lived up to what the book portrayed. So
the real movie and just kind of crashes and burns for you, this series.
Oh, big time, big time. It's actually kind of disappointing.
Sean, you keep referring to it as, and then this is where I really want you to weigh in here, though in the interest of time, keep it to 50 words or less. Use your best words. But you keep saying unintentionally hilarious. Now, I get, like, the awkward dialogue and romance stuff where, you know, you're kind of like, real people don't act this way. But what was it about a mortal giving birth to a vampire and having complications was funny to you?
Two things about it. First off, this one you're going to have to chalk up just to me being a veteran horror fan. I'm sorry. Watching Robert Pattinson chow down on her on her uterus was not gross to me. It was kind of funny, especially since later on at the end of the movie, you get this close-up of him just standing there, mouth agape, with blood, with just enough blood into the corner of his mouth that it looks like he just gulped down a big glass of Kool-Aid. and he just kind of has this expression like, I'm sorry, I don't know why. It's one of those things, I can't watch it, I can't see those images without just laughing at just how silly it looks. But the other one, oh, God, arguably the most priceless moment of this movie, imprinting. Jacob matures from a werewolf to a were-pedo bear.
Now, wait a minute. Now, see, I knew this is where you were going to go. They have already explained. Actually, I have a real problem with the imprinting, not because of the alleged pedophile stuff, because I think that's silly, but... I mean, look, for the purpose of this discussion, let me get this out there. The imprinting was described as a connection between the wolf and whoever he's imprinting on that is involuntary. It just happens. It's because sort of God decides who gets to be in love here and who belongs together. Okay, fine. The whole concept of, not to be too heavy with this, and I'm not going to go off on a tangent, but the whole concept of, you know, sexually molesting children or whatever, there's a certain degree of choice involved there. This took that completely out of it. And it was involuntary. It was just, again, it was just, this is how the wolves are and God intervenes. So
he's also not the only one who imprinted on a young child.
Right.
One of the other members of the pack is also imprinted onto, at the time, it's like a four-year-old or a five-year-old.
And it's not a sexual thing. It's more of a – if you're trying to find something it's akin to, it would be betrothing somebody. You know, you were born into this world, Princess Jehoshaphat, and you are betrothed to, you know, Prince Xanax, and you will to be together when it is time. Prince Valium, that was his name.
And either of those names would have been better than Renesmee.
I love the name Renesmee. Not that I would ever know my child that or anything, but...
So we're not going with Renesmee Rattledge on the second child?
No, Renesmee Rattledge.
But, Melissa, therein lies the problem. It's documented that has actually become one of the more popular baby names. Parents,
I do know that.
Stop naming your kids this.
All right, well, back to imprinting.
Oh, no, I'm totally with you on that.
Back to imprinting real quick. There's a lot. The problem with imprinting isn't the imprinting in and of itself, because, again, it was a device in the movie. It was part of the wolf lore. Deal with it, folks. He's not molesting a child. That's a different movie. That's American Beauty. Now, listen.
However.
Hang on.
We do eventually, however, thanks to imprinting in part, We do get Kristen Stewart's most hilarious line reading in this entire series.
Is it the Whoopi claim line?
You name our daughter after the Loch Ness Monster?
Yes. Hang on.
Scene was hysterical.
Hang on. I have
that whole
serious...
scene of her trying to be, like, serious and mad. Oh, my God. I was like, yeah, too little too late, my friend.
All right. I have a serious point to make with the imprint thing so that we can get on with this, and that is, well, this is one of those things that takes a movie with that's already got some problems, as we've been discussing, and weakens not just the movie that it's revealed, but weakens everything before it. And that is when Jacob's, you know, when they're discussed after the whole, you named my daughter the Loch Ness Monster and you have no Whoopi claim to her. And once we get past that salad of awkward dialogue reading, there's a serious thing that's said. And that is, don't you understand that it all makes sense? Remember when you wanted to be around me all the time and suddenly you can't be bothered with me? Well, that's because I was meant to be with Renesmee, and that's where all that was coming from. So I was destined to imprint on this child, and those feelings you had for me were not your own. They were actually your unborn child's. What the
Taylor,
fuck are
can
you
I buy some
about?
Pot from you?
Me or Jacob?
Jacob, can I buy some pot from you?
Okay, but a point that I was getting to with bringing that up is that weakens all of these other movies where they're supposed to be building a relationship between Bella and Jacob. What you're telling me now is that there really was no relationship. The relationship was with Renesmee and Jacob. This is like telling me that the Force isn't a spiritual thing. It's actually made up of fucking midichlorians. You just fucked up the entire movie. And everything that came before this, what you just said. What is wrong with you? Why would you do that? And is that an accurate thing in the book where they really don't have a relationship? He's actually been in love with the unborn child going all the way back to when he was 16?
They definitely, well, no, they have a real relationship. What the idea is supposed to be, though, is that, look, our relationship is the way it is. It's the complication that it is because I was destined to be imprinted to your child that we didn't know was going to happen. Like, this is why it all makes sense now.
But don't you think
can't you see this player was working the long con all along? He was just working the mother to get to that baby way down the line. He had
going all the way back to when she was struggling. Going all the way back to when she was struggling with the breakup of her and the vampire boyfriend. I could see where, boy, he is a criminal genius. Melissa, help me out here. And in 50 words or less, don't you think that undercuts the entire fucking movie at this point? I mean,
I don't think so. Well, here's my take on it is that it makes sense that they do have the complicated relationship because down the road this is this kind of, it's that whole idea of predetermination. I think what happens, and I think where you run into the issue, is the way it's portrayed and the way it's acted. I think that's where the issue lies. Because he does make it seem like, oh, we didn't have a relationship. It was really just me trying to get to this child that hadn't been born yet. But I do think, though, that it makes sense. I mean, it works.
For you. It did not work
for me.
For me,
it works.
John, any thoughts on, any serious thoughts, if you could be serious for a moment, any serious thoughts on imprinting Jacob, Bella, their relationship, and his sort of hidden relationship with unborn Renesmee?
I think this is one of the dumbest plot concepts I have ever heard.
Dumber than midichlorians.
Second dumbest plot concept I've ever heard.
Okay.
I'm sorry, precious few things top midichlorians. I could rattle off probably just a couple that I've heard, but not very many. This just I'm sorry, but you are now a cuddly CGI telepathic pedo bear.
Stop calling him a pedophile.
I'm sorry, he is pedo bear to me. He's not even well-rendered pedo bear.
Not about love, it was about protection. It was about destiny. He will always be there for her. That has nothing to do with pedophilia.
I just...
I'm with you, it's dumb. But it's not dumb for that reason. It's dumb because, you know, you just change... And Melissa disagrees, but you just change the whole concept of their relationship.
When I watched the actual imprinting scene... I wanted to surf through my iTunes and see if I had a recording of Close to You that I could start playing.
See, I just saw Pacific Rim, and all I could think about after the fact was this was The Drift.
I'm sorry, that whole scene was killed for me though with the horribly CGI baby.
Oh yeah, that was without a doubt the funniest part. Is just the baby.
Any minute now, the CGI baby was going to get up and sing, "Hello, my baby. Hello, my honey."
Yeah, it was horrible.
That was some Uncanny Valley shit right there.
Yeah.
All right,
that was
let's get to the heart and soul of Breaking Dawn 2. Now, for the purposes, in the interest of time, I will cut to the chase and just tell you what Melissa would have told you, which is in the book. Alice reveals to the Volturi that if they challenge the Cullen and the Wolves, the Cullen clan, their army of witnesses and the werewolves, they're all going to end up dead. And this is like a sentence in the book. And from that sentence, they create an entire half an hour, 45 minutes of vampire warfare in the snow. Where the Volturi,
yep.
The powerful, I mean, God, half in the bag really summed it up. Why did the vampires have to become mutants? Why did they have to become the X-Men?
Because apparently, for some reason, since she said she consciously avoided almost any and all vampire literature throughout the writing process of this, Stephanie Meyer eventually reached the conclusion that that's pretty much what vampires were. The blood-sucking X-Men.
Fair enough. Marvel's fear itself, Twilight. In any case, here is my whole thing on this, and this is where we're going to start to end our discussion of this, as I like to leave time for anything left unsaid for the two guests, for the guests and for Sean. But I don't like dusty finishes in movies. For those of you that don't know what the dusty finish is, Dusty Rhodes, when he was the booker in WCW, would book a match. The match would conclude. There would be shenanigans, and someone would then, I think, restart. Correct me if I'm wrong, Sean, would restart the match, and then the other guy would win.
That was generally the way it played out, yeah.
Yeah. So the false finish, the dusty finish, I don't like it. I don't like it in film. I don't like sort of dream endings, false endings, and that whole conclusion of the movie is a choose-your-own-adventure scene. You could go this way, and you'll all die. Or you could go this way, and you'll live. And considering the major motivation for that entire thing was done away with within 5 seconds with a conversation, I'm not going to slaughter villages of humans. I'm a half-mortal, half-vampire. I can have tacos or blood. It does not matter. And they're like, oh, okay, well, I don't really need to be here then. Oh, wait, I have this secondary motivation. I want to kidnap the one vampire who has fucking visions of the future. Fantastic. I'll start a war for that one reason. And, like, come on, this is some weak
shit. That's what they do to fill their time. Remember, they're bored.
Start wars for kidnapping. So essentially what you just said is the Volturi are Somali pirates. The whole concept is just kidnap people randomly.
Yes.
Fantastic. So I, as much as I enjoy a good fight scene, and this is where I want to defer to Melissa again, because your reaction, now you're not into gross, and you're not into...
I'm not into gross.
You're not into gross, and you're not necessarily into action movies, though you'll see it, you'll go to some with me, because some of this, like X-Men, Wolverine, it's in Japan, so you like that sort of thing. But Melissa, your reaction the very first time we saw Breaking Dawn 2, when they start to really slaughter each other.
I didn't like. I kept actually. I wanted to walk out of the movie theater.
We saw that one at home.
Did we? I thought we went out for that one.
No, you didn't. By the time Breaking Dawn 2 came out, you were like, I don't even want to see the end of this anymore. And then we were at home one day, and we were like, hey, it's on demand. Let's watch it. And then I remember I didn't watch the movie. I watched you, and I saw your mouth agape, you watching this and going, this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, I was so annoyed. I was so annoyed by it. The whole thing. I was just like, this is the worst. And then when they, the one where they keep the head off by, like, opening the mouth and ripping the top of the head off, I was just like, oh, this is so unnecessary and disgusting. Why?
Now, 50 words or less, why did this bother you exactly, other than this is not your wheelhouse?
Because it wasn't in the book. This is not in the book. This whole thing was completely 100% fabricated for the movie. In the book, literally, Alice takes Aero's hand, and he's like, well, this is what's going to happen if you decide to start a war, and it's not going to be pretty. And they don't go into deep discussion about it. They say, you know, in a couple of lines, you know, basically everybody's going to die, and you're not going to get what you want. And he goes, oh, okay.
And feeling like that wasn't a strong enough conclusion to this thing, this is what I said.
Yeah.
They really just should have ended it with, you know, the baby is born, she nearly dies, they turn her in order to save her, she wakes up a vampire, the end. This whole tacked-on thing with the witnesses and the Voltari sort of secondary gain in trying to kidnap Alice and all of that felt tacked on and just retarded.
Well, that was because they had to be true. That whole thing is they wanted to be true to the book. At that point, and that to me, I hate that they say that, because if you wanted to be true to the book, then you wouldn't have done the scene that way. But, you know, they really were trying to string the thing out for as long as humanly possibly to make more money, you know, to make more money than maybe they thought they would if they squished the two together. Because honestly, one and two, they should have just cut some things out, rearranged it a little bit, and just did one movie and have been done with it instead of dragging it out for a whole other year. Because you're right, and I'm not the only person who was kind of like, yeah, I don't even like seeing it anymore.
It broke you. The final epic fight scene just broke you, and all the women that just wanted to see a nice love story resolve itself.
Yep.
Sean, your final thoughts on the epic climactic fight scene?
Totally not how the Voltori would have ended it. Nope.
Okay.
Nope. I have to think that seeing what we've seen of the Voltori, I think that it probably would have ended with a big, epic, 35-minute Vampire the Masquerade LARP.
Okay. They all would have walked into the sun and turned into disco balls.
Followed by perhaps some Team Fortress 2.
It would have been awesome if Alice walks out, grabs his hand, and says, this is what will happen if you declare war on the Cullen clan, at which point they all strip, start to glow and sparkle, and you hear, young man, I said, young man. And we dance into the credits. And that's really all I have left to say about this series of movies. Melissa, your final word, anything left unsaid? We didn't really get a chance to talk about Charlie. I happened to say on Facebook, I said, you know, boy, the way Bella treats Charlie, her father, he just beats him like a rented mule through most of these movies. I feel bad for the guy. Anything left unsaid? Anything you want to talk about?
Nothing else unsaid. I mean, it's kind of one of those things where, you know, these movies are fun for a little while, and occasionally it's fun to go back and rewatch them. They definitely aren't any, you know, great masterpieces. They're just kind of thoughtless, mind-numbing, you know, entertainment for the most part.
Okay. Sean, your final thoughts, words, anything left unsaid, anything you want to talk about?
Not much. Just that, folks, really, there are some good aspects to this. There are parts of this movie that are really well shot visually. I have to hand it that. But as far as everything else goes, this is best watched with people, alcohol, and a desire to absolutely rip, just rip and riff the molten fuck out of something. just sit back with a few friends, have a good time, and just make absolutely every joke you want to. And by all means, if you can manage to get through all five of these movies in one evening or one sitting, my God, go touch a boob.
All right. Melissa doesn't blog, nor does she do a podcast. Melissa, so I don't – normally this is the section of the podcast where we plug things that we're going to be doing in the future, plug other projects that we are doing. I always defer to the guest first, but you can go on Disney.
I'm going back to school in a couple of weeks and educating the youth of America. So
that's
what I got going in my future.
I was going to say, you're going to go on a Disney board and read comments about cruises and Disney and stuff. That's what you do.
Possibly.
But
that's in between my pinning on Pinterest of things I'm going to do, considering we're implementing Common Core standards next year.
So here's what I'm going to do instead. I'm going to put you and Sean on the spot here. First, I want to ask you, how did you like your first live podcast?
It's not horrible.
I mean, you and I did some movie reviews a little ways back on YouTube. We did, I think, Up, and we did the Sex and the City movie, one of them, and you were kind of, nonplussed with those experiences.
I don't feel like I have enough interesting to say to warrant people listening to me talking. That's the problem.
Oh, I think Sean and I would agree. You were a very valuable asset to this podcast.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you.
So, since you didn't hate the experience, and you just got told by someone who you're married to and someone who you're not married to, who has no stake in the game, that you were a wonderful guest, can we get you on for, say, the American Pie franchise?
Possibly. We'll see.
Since I know you like stupid comedies, and that's on the list of ones
I love stupid comedies.
And I know that you enjoy the American Pie franchise. In fact, didn't you once say to me that, like, the American Pie franchise are sort of your generation's you may not have said Animal House, but they said that belonged to your generation.
I would claim it. Yeah, it's like my generation's Porky's.
Good comparison. Very good comparison.
So I think sometime before the end of the year, we're going to do the American Pie franchise, and we're going to bring you back. What do you think about that?
Does that mean you'll actually sit and watch the last one because you refuse to go to the movie theater to see it?
It will be the only reason for me to watch them.
Okay.
Oh, jeez. You have to watch American Wedding.
I liked those. I thought they were funny.
All right. So I appreciate the wife and mother of my child for deigning to stay awake past 9 o'clock to come
that
on.
Is,
and
that's just the biggest deal, by the way, that I am still up and it's 11:45.
You are the man. So, again, I appreciate that, and we will definitely have you back to do American Pie. If you ever decide, that you got the bug and you want to do more of these, you let me know and Sean know, and we'll figure it out. If you've got a franchise that you are particularly excited about, American Pie was the only one I could think of that would be suitable for you. But you let me know.
I'm sure Winfrey and I wouldn't mind a third for Hellraiser in October.
Yes, that'll never happen.
She'll be busy with her brother's wedding. The same reason I'm going to be busy.
It's not even that. It's more of I don't do horror very well.
No, instead we'll get her on for the Dark Knight. We'll forget Sam Riccati. We'll get her on for the Dark Knight trilogy just so she can.
That's because I watched that from your armpit.
Yeah, exactly.
While I texted my very best friend in the entire world going, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God.
So maybe something slightly less dark than the Dark Knight. No,
I like happy, shiny. I like lots of sunshine and rainbows. Okay.
Yeah.
Tinkerbell movies. Well, Mark, let's do the Tinkerbell movies.
There we go. We'll do the four Tinkerbell movies. It'll be fantastic.
We'll get Lily involved. I actually did have a friend of mine suggest at one point that we should do the Land Before Time movies.
Oh my God! I haven't watched those since I was a kid.
There you go.
Those are fabulous.
We have lots of kitty movies to do with Melissa. But all right, Melissa, I'm going to go ahead and excuse you from the podcast, and we'll close out with Sean. Sean, we have roughly 14 minutes to get all of our plugs and stuff in. So next in 2 weeks we'll be. So again, thank you very much, Melissa.
Thank you, Melissa.
In 2 weeks, if Lambert is not working and is not busy, we should be doing Transformers. We'll have Jeremy Lambert from Thoughts from the Man Cave on. I'll have to reach out to him to make sure that he will be available. And even if not, then you know we may stick with Transformers anyway and just do it without him. And then in August, we start the Aliens, Predators, and Alien versus Predator series with Sean's friend, hopefully. So that's what the next little over a month looks like on the Long Road to Ruin. You can go back in the Rattledge and Broadcasting Network on iTunes. Please rate us 5 stars on Stitcher. Please rate us 5 stars. And you can check out our podcast that we've done on Jurassic Park, on Superman, Star Wars, Return of the Jedi versus Revenge of the Sith, Spider-Man, the Batman series with Tim Burton and Joel Schumacher. All of our great podcasts are all there. Sean, what else you got going on?
Well, I would also add that we are also, of course, available over on ManicExpression.com. Go check them out. Wonderful site full of lots of other great videos and podcasts, a lot like this one. But myself, as I mentioned, I am no longer writing Music's 3 R's. I have liberated myself from that because I have something else I'm working on. This coming Monday, I am going to be debuting a new column on 411 Mania called Give Life Back to Music. It is what I would describe as a sort of combination, a sort of weird genetic splicing of Matthew Forsina's evolution schematic from the 411 Wrestling Zone with the weekly album review podcast that Mark and Robert Cooper do. I'm going to be going album by album through some of my favorite artists' catalogs and not so much reviewing them, but giving my thoughts on what I feel makes them great, but how they display each artist's progression throughout their careers. And I'm going to be starting off with a tricky one, but I think a pretty interesting one. I'm going to be starting off with Kanye West. So coming up, we're going to be kicking off this new project of mine that I hope you will all check out Monday evening with, I'm still working on actually writing it, either just a College Dropout itself or a combination review of the College Dropout and Late Registration. So check that out. And yeah, that's about all I got.
Okay. Opposite these podcasts on Tuesday nights do what's now being known as the Hammer of Doom podcast, formerly the 401 Music Zone podcast with the Three Beards, Robert Cooper, who also writes a column of the same name, the Hammer of Doom, on 401mania.com in the Music Zone. We finished up Megadeth, did a two-part retrospective of their career, and then we reviewed Super Collider. That's all on the Rattledge and Broadcasting Network. So please check that out. Next up on the hit list is Black Sabbath's new album, 13. So be so kind as to check us out a week from tonight live for our review of Black Sabbath 13. Every Sunday night is the MMA Ground and Pound show talking about MMA. This past week we took off, and instead you can find a special episode of the 401 Ground and Pound radio show where Sam Mercati and I deconstructed Anderson Silva. Separately from my own podcast under the Rattledge and Broadcasting banner, I'm a frequent guest on the casualheroes.com, who you can also find on iTunes. I'll be on their WrestleCast. I was just recently on their MMA cast, and a little ways back I was on their movie cast. So go to the casualheroes.com to hear me talk about more stuff. And finally, each and every week, John Brodigan and I get together to skewer the news on From the Right Radio's The Right Hook, Thursday nights at 9 o'clock. All right, Sean, what did you think of this podcast? Did you have a good time? Was this as painful as you thought it was going to be?
Okay, yeah, I played it up a little bit. No, I knew it was going to be a good time, and I had a fantastic time. Was wonderful getting to finally get acquainted with your lovely wife. I thought she was an outstanding guest and was a definite great resource since, again, there is less than a snowball's chance in hell I'm ever sitting through all four of these books. But, yeah. No, this was a good call, and I'm really looking forward to doing Transformers in 2 weeks, actually, because I know that Lambert has been looking forward to this for quite some time.
Yeah, do me a favor. I'll go post the stuff on Manic Expressions if you would go ahead and reach out to him and let him know the date is 2 weeks from tonight.
I'll let him know.
Okay. All right, folks. So this has been the Long Road to Ruins review of the Twilight Saga. For Sean Comer, for Melissa Rattledge, I am Mark Rattledge, the Mandated Reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified. Be well, be safe, and behave.